May I say, first of all, how very happy I am to be back on BBC Radio. It seems a long time, indeed it is a long time, since I was on the verge of becoming a child star in the Huey Green mould of the popular Midland Regional Follies in 1939. Just as it was really catching on, the show became a casualty of the Second World War. A war which more or less made Tommy Handley temporarily wiped me out. However, here I am back again, and in the 40 or so good, bad and indifferent years between, I've been involved in every facet of show business. But during all this time, the doors of the corporation have been closed to me. I can only surmise that this vault fuss on their part is due to a recent change of personnel on the fourth floor. A certain gentleman who's been elevated to a position with considerable clout has decided that it is in his interest to push a bit of work in my direction, hence my presence here now. This certain gentleman evidently prefers this arrangement to allowing me to tell a few stories elsewhere which feature himself. But you listeners are men and women of the world and will understand that in spite of the amazing revelations you're going to hear in the coming weeks, I'm not going to say anything about him. In other words, I have been in showbiz far too long to even consider biting the hand that feeds me, let alone reveal the name of its owner. Right. This story is about Brian Allington. That isn't his real name, it isn't even his stage name. If I used real names during the coming weeks, I'd be forced to live abroad in a country with no extradition agreement. Brian Allington was on the box again last night. He's doing really well. It was about the fourth time I've seen him this month, and at a peak hour, too. It's a long time since I was on tour with him in a whodunit that never got to town. I remember him so well as a young actor. Well, that's misleading in a way. Brian couldn't really act at all, in the way I understand the word. The play we were in was Murder by the Book. It was about a sadistic author who invites seven of his close friends to spend a weekend at his cottage and then tells them he's going to expose all their terrible secrets in his next book. After dinner, they play hide-and-seek with the lights out, and one of them kills the host. Brian played the part of his personal secretary. I was the butler. I merely came on a couple of times to give the audience a chance to laugh at domestic servants generally and to give the cast time to change out of their dinner jackets and backless dresses. But Brian was intended to be a prime suspect throughout. The trouble was, no audience ever believed for a moment that this innocent-looking young chap could possibly have plunged the assegai into the author's chest and then heaved his body onto the desk. Even when he confessed at the end of the play, they still didn't believe him. They thought he was confessing to shield someone else. Brian had that quality. People trusted him. After 6 weeks of a badly arranged tour, Brighton up to Newcastle, back to Bournemouth, up to Glasgow again, then over to Dublin, then up to Hull, Brian got wind of the fact that we were never going to see the bright lights of London's West End. He didn't risk offending the management by mentioning this. He merely told them that his half-sister was desperately ill in Zurich, and since they shared the same rare blood group, he had to fly over there and donate at least a quart. The management released him with a lot of public regret and then gleefully engaged someone even cheaper. During the tour, Brian had borrowed 15 quid from me, and before he left us, he asked me to make it a round figure, so I let him have another fiver. A fiver was a fiver in those days, and 20 quid represented 66 2/3 of my weekly salary. But as I waved him goodbye at the station, I never doubted I would get it back. It was only after the train had pulled out that I compared notes with the rest of the cast and discovered that Brian had borrowed a total of 85 quid from six of us. The other two actors he'd touched were pretty annoyed. But I think it's significant that the three ladies who'd parted would not hear a word against him. They were quite convinced that dear Brian would be sending them checks as soon as he sorted things out in Switzerland. One of them had given him a farewell present of a bottle of hog's liver tablets to replace the blood he was going to have drained off into his half-sister. A few years after the ill-fated tour ended in Aberdeen, wouldn't you know, I was acting in the West End. Not in Murder by the Book, needless to say, no. In a play which everyone assured me had been put on to make a tax loss for the backer. He was a respected businessman who'd made a fortune building modern airy slums. The story was that he loved showbiz and preferred to put his money into it than into the coffers of the Inland Revenue. Personally, I could never understand the logic of this. If it was true, why did he engage the cheapest cast he could find and then ask them to take cuts in salary after the first 2 weeks? Nevertheless, it was nice to be on Shaftesbury Avenue after so many years on the road, and I enjoyed going home to my little flat rather than to crummy digs in provincial cities indifferent to live theatre, particularly as I had recently formed a meaningful relationship with a young lady, youngish. So every Saturday I used to check in early for the matinee to see if there was an announcement that the play was coming off, and when I didn't find it, was able to luxuriate in one more week of comparative security. After one of these Saturdays, just after the curtain came down on the second house, who should appear at the stage door but Brian Allington? He breezed into my dressing room unannounced, having convinced the stage doorkeeper that he was an old friend of mine. I was almost ready to leave and meet my girlfriend downstairs, but Brian settled down on the other stool and told me how thrilled he was to see me in the West End in what he described as an enormous hit. I told him we were just hanging on week by week. "Nonsense," he said, "you'll be here for years. I envy you, Jacko, you've got it made." His enthusiasm was beginning to get through to me. "Do you really think the play is that good?" "I haven't seen the play." "You haven't seen it? I wanted to see you. Then how do you know it's so good?" "I don't need to see it to know that. With all those wonderful reviews..." "The reviews were terrible." "Not the ones I read. Anyway, reviews never matter at the grassroots. The man in the street doesn't pay any attention to the critics. The British man in the street and his wife like to make up their own minds. Take my word for it, you're in a smash hit." At this point, my date arrived. Nadia was the girl I mentioned earlier as being, at the time, a distinct possibility as a long-term partner. Brian was just as enthusiastic about her as he was about the play. He raved about her classic features and sophisticated charm and said how envious it made him feel. Then he told Nadia what a wonderful person I was and how thrilled he was that I'd finally made it and how he looked forward to the other successes that he knew were coming my way. Suddenly he looked round and asked if we couldn't drink to our reunion. I didn't have anything in the dressing room. It wasn't the sort of room in which one entertains. In fact, it was the sort of room a derelict might quietly starve to death in, ignored by the social services. Nadia had the answer. "Go and get a bottle from Gerald downstairs. He's always got plenty." "Or I could pop out and get a bottle at the off-license round the corner," said Brian, not moving a muscle. Nadia wouldn't hear of such a thing. So off I went downstairs to catch Gerald Bannerman, who played the drunken doctor so realistically. He was very decent about it and made me a present of a bottle of Chilean Cabernet Sauvignon, the only one left out of the 24 he'd brought in on the Monday. He lent me 2 glasses and a tooth mug as well. When I got back to my room, Brian was telling Nadia how very popular I'd been with the Murder by the Book company. This gave me what I thought was a good opportunity to bring up the subject of the fiver he'd borrowed just before he left and the 15 he had already owed. "Jacko's got a memory like an elephant where money is concerned," said Nadia, disloyally, I thought. Brian laughed, but he saw I wasn't amused. He immediately said how pleased, how very, very pleased he was that I'd reminded him. "Not like him," he said, "to let a thing like that slip his mind. When a friend gave one a helping hand, then the least one can do is remember and do the decent thing. It wasn't possible," he said, "to give it back to me this moment, because that very morning he'd given all his spare cash to a bailiff to save his old nanny from a brutal eviction order. But he assured me I should have a check first post on Tuesday." "That's fine," I said, "fine." Nadia looked at me impatiently. "We were having such a nice chat," she said, "and you had to bring up sordid old money." I gave my best disarming shrug and changed the subject. "How is your half-sister?" I asked Brian. He looked at me blankly. "She's fine," he said. "You remember you had to leave the company to go to her aid." "That's right, of course. I'm so glad you reminded me. I'm surprised you could forget a thing like that." I'll never forget. It was just that you mentioned it out of context, he turned to Nadia. Poor darling, she was robbed by a gang of Corsican hotel thieves in Antibes. Robbed, I said. Lost everything, passport, traveller's checks, credit cards, the lot. Absolutely stranded. It cost me a fortune to replace everything and pay the hotel bill and so forth. But she's a sweet girl. I'd do anything for her. You told us you had to go to Zurich to give her some of your rare blood. Ah, yes, you're quite right to mention that. I'm afraid she's always tended to turn to me for help. And there have been so many emergencies. Poor darling, I won't say she's accident-prone, but let's say she's been very unlucky. Odd you should forget a thing like that, I said. Giving your blood is so very basic. Oh, it's happened too many times, that's the trouble. There are only two other potential donors, and they're in Western Australia. Jacko, said Nadia, Brian's come a long way to see you tonight, and I'm sure he doesn't want to be reminded of unhappy things that happened long ago. I said I didn't know Brian had come a long way. I was beginning to feel hungry, and it was now well past the time when I'd expected to have my knees under the table at my little flat opposite Nadia. I only came from Brighton, said Brian. But when I read in the Argus that you were in this smash show, I felt I had to jump on the train and bask in the old reflected glory. I would have come to the play, but I was delayed by a stranded Norwegian at Victoria. I helped him find a hotel. But it's great to see you, Jacko. He shared out the remaining plonk between himself and Nadia. Now I must dash off and catch the train. He embraced us both and repeated most of the effusive things he'd said already, and off he went. Nadia was quite grumpy with me over the supper, which had been simmering away all day in my new electric casserole. I'd gone to a lot of trouble over that stew, bay leaves, button, mushrooms, red wine, the lot. After a milk stout apiece, drunk in silence, I asked her to come out with it. What's the matter? The way you acted with Brian. It was just as if you didn't believe him or something. It was as if you didn't think he would send you the check on Tuesday. It was just an instinct I had. Call it my masculine intuition. If that's what it is, it's feeding you false information. Of course he'll send it. He'll send it at the same time he sends the 20 quid to me. What 20 quid to you? The 20 I lent him. Lent him when? When you were borrowing the wine from Gerald. I was only gone 5 minutes. What does that mean? That he's a fast worker. I thought he was a friend of yours. I never said that. He's someone I worked with ages ago, someone who owes me 20 quid. You as well, now. He's trying to get some money together to help a poet get out of Czechoslovakia. What? A poet? Brian is trying to help him to emigrate. With 20 quid? I shouldn't think 20 quid would get a bloody hamster out of Czechoslovakia, let alone a poet. Poet, really? You're so cynical, Jacko.
I had good cause to be.
It was the reasons Brian gave that got under my skin. The rare blood group, the thieves, not just ordinary thieves, they had to be Corsicans. And it was a poet he was helping, a Czechoslovakian poet. Brian never wanted money to pay his rent or his phone bill or keep up maintenance payments. With Brian, it had to be something exotic.
Needless to say, I never received the promised cheque, never heard a word of any kind. And after that evening at the theatre, when Brian called round, things between Nadia and me were never the same. I was the villain of the piece, so far as she was concerned, and the more I attempted to justify my attitude, the wider the gulf between us grew. In the end, Nadia came to the conclusion that I was even more cynical than the husband from whom she was having a trial separation, and she went back to him. Several years passed, with no news of Brian. And then, late one night, he phoned me. Jacko, it's your old mate, Brian. Great news, Jacko, old chum. I've landed a plum job. I've given up acting and taken a regular job. A new PR firm starting up. It's a terrific break for me, and the best thing about it is that it means I shall be able to pay off all my debts. I've felt terrible about owing you that money all these years. How is Nadia, by the way? I told him she was no longer part of my life. Shame, lovely girl. I must get in touch with her and pay her back, too. But my debt to you goes back even further. I must settle that first. Could we have lunch tomorrow? Yes, I'm free. Great. 1 o'clock at the Piazza. Is that okay with you? Very nice. Excellent. But I do have one problem. My heart sank. Could you possibly put me up tonight? Never mind a bed. Is there room for me to curl up on the floor? I'm in North London, and I shall never catch the train to Sevenoaks.
You've left Brighton, then?
Oh, ages ago. I'm looking for a place near Trafalgar Square, so that I can be near my work. What do you say? Would it be an awful bore if I came round in a few minutes?
Well, I thought, considering he's giving me lunch tomorrow, and I'm going to get my money back, I suppose I can't very well refuse.
All right, I said. You're a pal, Jacko. I'll bring a bottle along, and we can have a nightcap and chat about old times.
Half an hour later, Brian arrived. Needless to say, there was no sign of any nightcap, nor any luggage. The next morning, he borrowed my shaving things and had a bath and rushed off to an appointment with the PR firm. We didn't talk much. Brian was on the phone most of the time, and not all the calls were local. He promised to settle up for these when we had our lunch at the piazza. When he arrived, he was bubbling with excitement.
"It's all fixed," he said. "Signed the contract this morning. I start work on Monday. Let's order lunch."
Egged on by Brian, I disregarded all considerations of cost and ordered a very good meal. So did he. Over the veal masala and a bottle of Tenuta di Capizzana 81, he told me all about the wonderful opportunities his new job had opened up. Travelled to New York and L.A., where the firm were going to open offices, and all the famous clients Brian would be wining and dining. Over the coffee, he brought up the question of the money he was going to repay. I was relieved. I'd begun to think I should have to bring up the subject myself. "Now, the way I propose to pay you is this," he said, "by post-dated cheque. I shan't get my first salary for 3 weeks, so I'm going to give you a cheque dated a month from today. Is that okay?" I was disappointed, but what could I say? It had been a very good lunch.
"Yes, that's okay." "Excellent. Now, there's one other problem. Getting this job organized has cost me a lot in entertaining and chasing around. It's left me terribly short of ready cash. What would make life a great deal easier for me would be for you to give me a cheque for, say, round £100, and I'll make my post-dated cheque out for the £100, plus the amount I already owe you, and Nadia's £20 as well." I felt a distinct throbbing in the temples.
£100, I said, "no chance, impossible."
"What about 50? He took out his cheque-book.
"I've only got just enough to see me through to the end of the month."
"How much is that?"
"60-odd.
"That's fine. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll lend you another 100, so you'll know that next month you'll have a balance. That's 100 plus the 60 you're lending me, plus 20 I owe you from way back, and Nadia's 20.
He started writing. "That's 200.
Is that enough, Jacko? Would you like me to let you have some more?"
No, I said, no.
"Okay, now if you want more next month, you know where to come. Just let me have your cheque for 60. Today is the 19th.
You know what I did? I made out a cheque payable to Brian Allington for £60, my balance at the bank being 62. Looking back, I realise I should have sought psychiatric help. Brian took my cheque, looked at it for a moment, and stuffed it into his wallet.
"Thanks, Jacko, you're a real pal."
He tore his own cheque out of the book, folded it over, and tucked it into my breast pocket. "Pay that in first thing tomorrow morning, then it'll be safe until it's honoured 4 weeks from today. By the way, do you mind if we go Dutch?" He beckoned for the bill. By this time, I was traumatized. If Brian had got up, removed my jacket, and torn the shirt from my back, I believe I should have sat there and let him. My share of the lunch came to enough to keep me for 10 days in the frugal style I adopt when waiting for something to turn up. I didn't hurry to put the cheque in the bank, knowing that it had not been cleared for a month, but when I received a 19p TV repeat fee for a programme that had been sold to Brunei, I thought I might as well bank Brian's cheque at the same time. I took it out of the breast pocket of the suit I'd been wearing on the day of the lunch. I looked at it. My knees gave way. I sat down. I looked out of the window, blinked a few times, and looked back at the cheque. There was no doubt about it. He'd written out the correct amount, he'd filled in the correct figures. The name J. Kingston Platt was clearly written, so was the date. But he hadn't signed it. The questions flashed into my mind like a speeded-up montage. Where was Brian? Could I find him? Had he done it on purpose? Could I trace the PR firm he was working for? Would the bank help me to trace him? Where would next month's rent come from? These questions swiftly changed into overall turmoil. I told myself not to panic. I didn't listen to my own instructions. I think I was really in danger of flipping my trolley. Fortunately, I was saved by a phone call. It was an availability inquiry.
By sheer instinct, I was able to discuss the possibility of a summer season at the least popular of all East Coast resorts with a feigned eagerness indistinguishable from the real thing. I could be wrong about that because I never heard from the man again. But the call did serve to snap me out of the black mood brought on by the unsigned check and the knowledge that I'd let myself be conned by Brian yet again. That was the last time I ever saw him in person. I wrote to him, care of the bank and also care of equity, but eventually my letters were returned. Then, 6 months ago, I saw him on the box. Sprucer, leaner, and putting his case very convincingly. I won't tell you the name of the constituency he is actually a candidate for, but I should think he has a very good chance of getting in. And they've already announced that he'll be speaking for at least 3 minutes on the next party political broadcast. It's my belief he will be elected. And if he's backed the winning party, then I anticipate a cabinet post within 2 years. I'd be surprised if he isn't in the top job of all within five. It's not just that he's an ex-actor and we tend to imitate America in everything, but that he is a wonderful front man. I can't decide whether to ask him for the money he owes me now or wait until he moves up in the corridors of power. If I delay too long, he might get into a position to have me liquidated, because I know he will never part with money without putting up a fight. On the other hand, he might choose to placate me with a few favours like a government grant, a cushy job in the Arts Ministry, or even a useful title. Who knows? He might even be able to get me onto Desert Island Discs. I play no part in this story myself, but it happened at a time when I was trying to break into television in the early days and concerned a man I had a lot of time for, Raymond Lestrange. Some of my older listeners may remember him as the ace producer of such popular programs as Raymond's Room, Raymond Lestrange Presents, and The Lestrange Follies. Raymond's real name was Ray Trench, and he was the son of a Staffordshire sheet metal worker. He was a dunce at school, and when he was called up in the early days of the war, he looked round for a quiet job in the forces and settled on the entertainment branch. He served without distinction for 4 years and was demobbed into a world not exactly waiting to welcome the international impresario and entrepreneur named Raymond Lestrange, who Ray Trench had invented, christened, and by then firmly believed himself to be. After being involved in a few prior-to-London tours of revues and musical comedies which never came within 100 miles of the metropolitan area, Raymond Lestrange got himself a job at Ali Pali, where, according to the Radio Times, television history was being made. He started out as assistant floor manager on quiz shows and glove puppet productions for kids, and soon became a producer in his own right. Or wrong, as we sometimes say. He decided to specialise in the television spectacular, and indeed was one of the first people to use this term. To come out with that word spectacular without a trace of embarrassment when the largest screen in the country was 8x10 required a certain amount of character, not to say fanatical enthusiasm. This was the quality that Raymond had. He started his career as a producer proper by presenting Raymond's Room. The Room was supposed to be a very exclusive nightclub in the heart of London's Mayfair. The entertainment was provided by international acts assembled to coincide with their appearances at nightclubs and cabarets in London. Raymond's expertise lay in presenting them in an attractive manner and in publicising himself so that his name came to be a guarantee of a certain type of show with a high standard of professionalism. At the end of Raymond's Room, I remember, the illuminated stars in the ceiling dropped one by one, still glowing, onto the cabaret floor. A camera slung precariously from the roof picked out the design made there, presented by Raymond Lestrange. Well, the cost of this egocentric effect was out of all proportion to its value as entertainment. But Raymond's bosses were indulgent with him because of his childlike enthusiasm and willingness to work round the clock. Indeed, so enthusiastic was he that he actually liked staying up all night and sending out for liver sausage sandwiches and draft beer instead of breaking for a proper meal. I think he had a touch of genius. He was tireless. No one ever saw him tired. Twice he got married in those post-war years, and both his wives were really in love with him. But both marriages failed because Raymond was hardly ever at home. And when he was either on the phone or entertaining writers, agents, designers, and the rest. He was the classic example of the man who ate, slept, talked, nothing but showbiz morning, noon, and night. No woman could have stuck it, and neither of them did. And then he met Elaine Allenbury. Elaine's grandparents were a Russian Tsarist general and a French ballet dancer, and a Kinsale Spanish aristocrat and a Dawson City dance hostess who was half Cherokee. With such a mixture, it would be difficult to guess from whom she inherited her traffic-jamming good looks. Very likely they all contributed something. Anyway, you can take it from me that the result was a genealogical smash hit. She was also very rich. It was not easy to see, really, why she fell in love with Raymond in the first place. My theory is, and it is only a theory, that Elaine realized Raymond was deeply in love with his work in a way that few people are deeply in love with anything. And she felt confident in her powers to redirect all this emotional voltage in her own direction. Once Elaine had decided to have him, Raymond's number was up. In a matter of days, he responded with an enthusiasm he normally reserved for cricketing elephants, bicycling bears, and Edith Piaf. The same week that saw the meeting of Elaine and Raymond in the BBC canteen at Alexandra Palace also saw the arrival there of a young graduate who had appeared with some success in a university review and had been signed up by the corporation and attached to Raymond in a sort of apprentice capacity. His name was Brian Price, and he was a bright and eager 22 with a flair for satirising everyone of 23 and over. Preoccupied as he was with his love affair, Raymond didn't have a great deal of time and energy left over for Master Brian. But he did, conscientiously, try to show him the important ropes. For instance, he introduced him to Gavin, the special effects man, without whose cooperation no production could be transmitted successfully. Raymond also introduced useful people in the shape of arrangers who could get anyone through musically and designers who could do the same visually. These vital helpers, nursed and cherished by Raymond, were not much appreciated by the brilliant Brian, who, having read several books on how silent films were produced in the Soviet Union and seen the Busby Berkeley season at the University Film Club, believed that he had something original and uniquely his own to bring to the exciting new medium of telly. At the time, six shows were in preparation. Gala Night in Paris, Gala Night in Venice, and Gala Night in four other capitals. I believe when this idea was first mooted, or conceived, as Raymond always put it, the shows were to be called Raymond Lestrange's Paris, Raymond Lestrange's Venice, etc. But since Raymond was now going to be on his honeymoon when they were scheduled for production, the responsibility was left to young Brian, and they were called Gala Night In, etc. Though I believe Brian did actually suggest that they could be called Brian Price's Paris, and so on. This crummy idea was vetoed, but it did a great deal to prejudice people against Brian before he even started work. Raymond proved his matrimonial seriousness by agreeing to a fashionable wedding at St. George's Hanover Square, with a reception at Grosvenor House afterwards. The happy groom also arranged a four-week honeymoon in quiet but very expensive hotels in the Cotswolds, the Lake District, and finally a small pub outside Aylesbury. He really convinced his lovely bride that he was going to leave showbiz behind for the duration of the honeymoon. Naturally, since I was not on the honeymoon with them, this part of my story is largely conjecture. I can only guess at what happened. I think I mentioned that the last night of the honeymoon was at a small pub outside Aylesbury. Buckinghamshire was at that time a particularly good reception area. And it was also the night that Brian Price was in the control room at Ali Pali for the first time. There was, I would guess, a certain amount of disquiet on Elaine's part when Raymond insisted on watching the box that night in preference to enjoying her own colourful three-dimensional charms. What Raymond's reactions to the show were can only be guessed at. But I know Raymond, and of course I saw the show. Gala Night in Venice, it was called. It should have been Gala Night in Paris, but before he left, Raymond had applied to the booking department for Maurice Chevalier himself. There was a misunderstanding about fees because he asked so many thousands that the BBC thought he was talking in francs, but it turned out he was talking in pounds, so the deal fell through. Then it was arranged for a well-known impersonator to do an impersonation of Maurice Chevalier, backed by 28 girls wearing straw boaters just in case viewers didn't recognise the impersonation. Then it was discovered that the intricate water arrangements for the following show, Gala Night in Venice, could only be made on the night that Gala Night in Paris was scheduled. Raymond, in similar circumstances, would have had a drink with Gavin, the effects man, and made some sort of compromise arrangements with him. But not Brian. He first of all tried to turn the circumstances to advantage by planning to use the Venetian canals as Paris streets in the Paris in the Rain sequence on the original date, and do Gala Night in Venice without canals at all. But the gondolas were already being built, and anyway the famous Italian tenor who'd been engaged would not agree to appear in a show about Paris, but did agree to the date being changed. The 28 straw boaters which had been purchased were both paid for and returned to the manufacturer. They were paid for because someone at the BBC pointed out that the corporation had a responsibility to the small businessman, and they were returned because someone else at the BBC pointed out that the corporation must not waste the licence payer's money. Rehearsals began. The first casualty was the famous Italian tenor who lost his voice in Vienna singing Rigoletto. A lesser-known Italian tenor was engaged. He only lasted half a day, and then he went down with something he described as English tummy. The next tenor was a completely unknown Italian who turned out to be a baritone, and anyway got lost somewhere between Milan and London, possibly in the customs shed. Finally, an Irish tenor was engaged, and extra fees were agreed when he was told he would have to dress in gondolier costume and propel a gondola. In all fairness to Brian, he inherited a whole heap of trouble from the absent Raymond. For instance, Raymond was addicted to animals in his shows and hired them from a pet dealer named Ramage, who happened to be a founder member of his local migraine club. Long before Raymond even met Elaine, he'd booked four swans from pain-racked Mr. Ramage, and no one thought of cancelling the arrangement. Rehearsals started badly and got rapidly worse. The special effects man, Gavin, was alienated very early on. A grave error, this, because he was very proud of his water. The musical director was bawled out in front of his orchestra and told he had no sense of tempo and was probably tone-deaf as well. Mr. Ramage, with a splitting headache, was left in a dressing room with his four swans until someone remembered him and threatened him with prosecution for cruelty to animals. Someone else told him it was against BBC rules to allow birds in dressing rooms and that he would probably be prosecuted. And a third person, preparing the firework finale, exploded a maroon a few feet from his ear and increased his migraine and unhinged all four swans. The only person on the production who remained unruffled and confident was the Irish tenor Michael O'Hanrahan. After his morning rehearsals, when the musical director had been insulted by Brian, O'Hanrahan had retired to his dressing room and remained there, waiting for his call to do the actual show. With him were no fewer than 24 bottles of his national beverage, which he referred to whimsically as tranquilizers. At 5 o'clock, the unit broke for tea, even though the finale had not been rehearsed. Many of those about to take part in the show must have felt like soldiers about to go over the top against overwhelming odds. So the time for the show approached. Imagine, if you can, Raymond and his lovely bride sitting in the television lounge of the pub in Buckinghamshire waiting for the much-publicised spectacular to begin. For the first time on the honeymoon, Raymond smoked cigarettes and forgot to offer any to Elaine. Together, they watched a particularly dull documentary about the fish canning industry in British Columbia. After 30 boring minutes, the end titles faded, and then one word filled the screen. It seemed to be in letters of the Russian alphabet, but the quicker-witted viewers just had time to realise it was the word interlude upside down before the immaculate top half of MacDonald Hobley appeared. Reassuring and apparently quite confident, he announced that the big show of the week was about to begin. Gala Night in Venice. He didn't manage to get the last syllable out before his image disappeared and was replaced by the potter's wheel going round and round above a caption which said interlude, this time the right way up. This shaky prelude must have shaken Raymond, and I expect he increased his consumption of cigarettes and very likely sent out for a liver sausage sandwich, always a sign that he was feeling tense. He would know that the uncertainty at Alley Pally was a symptom of something being wrong. Exactly what could not be kept a secret much longer? Suddenly, it happened. The caption was withdrawn. Another interlude, this time fish swimming in a murky tank, and then, after about 2 seconds of that, the opening titles of Gala Night in Venice. We first saw a badly lit replica of the Ponte Rialto with a workman in white overalls hammering nails into one of the supports. The orchestra struck up Carnival in Venice, and the workman, hearing this, looked at the camera and walked straight across the canal through water, which was now seen to be only about an inch deep. Then, believe it or not, we saw another caption, devised and produced by Raymond Lestrange. Raymond, sitting in the pub, he must have flipped. It must have been like a blow in the solar plexus, but worse was to follow. He was to get a right, left to the body and several beautifully timed blows to the chin. To begin with, the water started to gurgle away. It fell below the level necessary to conceal the casters on the gondola. Nevertheless, down what appeared by now to be merely a damp street, on came the gondola, with the Irish tenor aboard and full of what he had described as his tranquilizers. He was tranquilized as a newt. The musical director, by now suffering many of the symptoms of acute shell shock, slowed the orchestra in order to help the tenor. The tenor put on a spurt to help the orchestra. Just as they were all in danger of grinding to a halt, Mr. Ramage, the pet expert with the migraine, released his four swans from their wicker basket, and they flew not towards the water near the bridge, but straight out of camera range and into the middle of the orchestra. The musicians, like everyone else in this country, had been taught from birth that a swan can break a man's arm with its wing and attempted to escape, many of them sacrificing their expensive instruments to do so. The noise was deafening. Well, it had to be heard to be believed. Looking back on it now, it's amazing that the Irish tenor was able to continue singing, but he did, and thus confirmed the suspicion of all of us except Byron Price that he was a pub singer born and bred. The scene after the Ponte Rialto was supposed to be three jugglers in the Piazza San Marco. This was in a worse state of preparedness than the Ponte Rialto. The three jugglers did well to keep their clubs up in the air at all under the trying circumstances. The church actually started to disintegrate behind them. A lot of water missing from the previous scene had flowed across the studio and had soaked into the lath and plaster base. It started to sink. Slowly at first, but with gathering speed, like a souffle in a very cold room. After watching about a quarter of an hour of this catastrophic show, which through some departmental blunder bore his name, Raymond jumped into his Bentley and drove like a maniac to Alexander Palace. I don't know what passed between him and the lovely Elaine. She probably begged him to stay with her. She may have suggested going with him. We don't know. All we do know is that he went alone. We also know from subsequent events that that was the end of the marriage. They were never able to pick up the pieces, as they say in the movies. On his arrival at Alley Pally, the show was over, and Raymond found Brian sitting alone in the control room which overlooked the deserted studio, scene of the debacle. What exactly was said again, we don't know. But next morning, at 10 sharp, Raymond was busy rehearsing the next show in the series, Gala Night in Paris. He bought liver sausage sandwiches and draft beer for the entire cast by way of celebration of his return. Ray Trench was dead forever, and Raymond Lestrange was himself again. Elaine appeared later that morning, and the newlyweds were seen together for a few minutes at lunchtime, and that was all. Anyway, Raymond had no time. He worked at tremendous speed, a man inspired. He won the admiration of all concerned, with two notable exceptions, his young wife and Brian Price. They stayed in the background. They stayed in the background together. All through the rehearsals, they sat whispering to each other and laughing quietly as though sharing jokes too clever to communicate to anyone else. Everyone on the show must have noticed their self-absorption. I think even Raymond must have noticed it, preoccupied though he was. Well, when production day finally dawned, Raymond enjoyed one of the greatest triumphs of his career. I am here to tell you it was one of the most memorable TV shows ever to come out of dear old Alley Pally. A zonking, woofing, copper-bottomed stonewall smasheroo. I remember the finale. Well, shall I ever forget it? 28 girls in straw boaters, purchased and paid for a second time, danced round a replica of the Eiffel Tower, singing "Every Little Breeze Seems to Whisper Louise." They were supported by the rest of the huge cast. Bearded waiters in smocks and wide-brimmed hats, can-can dancers, knockabout monks, whistling apaches, comic waiters, and American tourists with cameras. Nice touch of satire here. Finally, as the music faded, the lights changed, and the 28 girls bowed towards the cameras, and on the crown of each straw hat was a letter of the alphabet picked out in luminous paint. Together, the hats spelt out the magic phrase, "Presented by Raymond Lestrange." It was a triumph. The orchestra burst their guts playing "Ça c'est Paris." Everyone cheered. Everyone except Brian Price and Elaine. They were in Paris. In Paris and no doubt having a marvellous time. The inevitable divorce followed some months later, and they were married in Mexico City and settled down to a fashionable life in Acapulco. She was loaded, I think I told you. Brian never did a stroke of work again, and was able to stop satirizing the rich because he became one of them. What did Elaine see in him? In a way, it was the same thing that attracted her to Raymond. Brian loved Brian so much that Elaine felt if only that love could be converted to her own person, she would have a lover of Olympian quality. I don't know how it worked out, but to my mind, Brian wasn't good convert material. Raymond still produces the odd nostalgic spectacular, still eats liver sausage sandwiches and drinks draft beer, loves to sit in the BBC club and reminisce about the old days at Alley Pally, mentions Gala Night in Paris quite frequently, Gala Night in Venice very seldom.
The Dick Turpin TV series was one of the biggest disasters the small screen has ever known. If the 7 episodes made ever do see the light of day, it will be very late at night, if you know what I mean. The producer was Hal Minchintrope. Hal worked in Hollywood in the old days before the actors got the upper hand, or, as Louis B. Mayer put it, before the lunatics took control of the asylum. In common with President Truman, Winston Churchill and Vera Lynn, Hal didn't taste real big-time success until the Second World War. He came over to London on an expense account holiday and was amazed when people rushed at him with open wallets. Insurance companies, institutional investors and the like had got wind of Hal's ability to make $2 grow where one had grown before. It took many years for them to rumble the fact that this ability of his had nothing to do with making movies or TV series. The thing about Hal was that after each flopperoo, he personally emerged richer than ever. I am going to tell you how he did it. The day after he decided to go into business over here, he bought a crumbling old Victorian house in Camden Town, and before he was in production, he had it restored by expert craftsmen working in his company's time, and it quickly became a valuable Regency gem. He bought antique furniture, pictures and art treasures to furnish it. What happened was that Hal sold the stuff to Hal, who hired it out to Hal, until Hal bought it back and paid Hal a commission for all the trouble Hal had gone to. He had a wonderful flair for getting everyone to help him. Even the tax people cooperated. they allowed him to deduct 33% for depreciation on antiques that actually doubled in value during the making of the three costume pictures he produced. This all happened at a time when demand for my own services had dried up to a mere trickle. Even trickle is an exaggeration. There was no sign of moisture of any kind. One day, I was reduced to calling on my cousin, the motor salesman, with the idea of touching him for a fiver. He refused. I was about to leave the car showroom when I spotted Hal coming in. His picture had been in the papers a lot because he was having trouble with the film unions, who, naturally enough, didn't want this Yankee coming over here and exploiting our workers in a way not permitted in America. Much to my cousin's annoyance, I introduced myself. I didn't mention I was an actor, of course. I knew that would frighten him. I presented myself more as a fellow entrepreneur. "Rumour has it," I said, "that you're having trouble with the unions. I think I might be able to help you there. Come to that, I could also help you get a much better role than that cannibalised job over there, and for about half whatever that crook is charging you." This intrigued him. "You do," he said, "and I'll show my appreciation." He walked straight over to my cousin and cancelled the purchase. My cousin's face was a heartwarming sight. As if poleaxed, he tottered to the door and watched us stroll over to his arch-rival across the street. I introduced Hal, and knowing a little bit about the sale of old cars, I was able to help him buy an authentic bargain with the original Mulliner coachwork, which had never been driven by anyone under 60 years of age. I didn't realise at the time that he was charging the Rolls to his Dick Turpin account. "A Rolls-Royce in the 17th century, I hear you ask?" "Yes. Hal's story to the taxman was that it was to be used in the prologue, when a present-day descendant of Dick Turpin's would be seen driving it through the Highlands, would disappear into a patch of Scotch mist and reappear out of it on horseback and in period costume to the sound of some pretentious music. Needless to say, this sickening device was jettisoned before shooting began, leaving Hal with the use of the vehicle. Well, true to his word, he showed his appreciation by inviting me to join him for lunch at his club. Of course, he was intrigued by what I'd told him about the unions. So, over a sumptuous meal, I told him about the rapport I'd established over the years with my friends in the union office. Well, we got on like a house on fire. By the time we got to the cognac, Hennessy XO, and cigars, Davidoff Cohibas, I was co-producer and had a brief to engage crew and personnel. We would have got on to casting, but Hal had an appointment with a horse trainer who, he said, was waiting for him in the lobby. "We'll talk about casting tomorrow," he said. "Be at my house in Camden Town at 10 o'clock. He escorted me to the entrance and introduced me to the trainer, a red-faced man in a loud hacking jacket and brown trilby called Frank Burley, who smiled with very tight lips and gave me a Masonic handshake. I gave him one back. I don't like secret societies and power groups, particularly ones I don't belong to, so if I can make a brother feel uncertain and insecure, I do. Burley volunteered the information that he was there to help Hal buy a horse to play the part of Black Bess in the series. "Not a horse," said Hal, laughing. "Horses!" Burley smiled, but obviously didn't know what the joke was. I saw Hal into a taxi and walked away feeling quite euphoric. The next morning, as arranged, I arrived at Hal's beautiful house in Camden Town. He took me up to the studio, which occupied the whole of the top floor. In the centre was a huge refectory table on which were piled about 200 scripts. "I bought these 20 years ago," he said. $20 a piece. World rights, radio, TV, films, every known medium so far invented, and any which may be invented in the future. If the Dick Turpin show has legs, as we hope, then we have the scripts here for 26 shows a year for 8 years. I picked one up. "But are these Dick Turpin scripts?" I said. "They soon will be," he said. "Did you ever hear of the Lone Ranger?" Well, of course I had. "When that show was on the radio back home in the 30s, he said, it had several imitators. Some were better than the original, but they never took off because the Lone Ranger happened to get in first. He patted the piles of scripts. This imitation was one of the best. The Tall Stranger. Same cloppity-clop with a coconut shell, same kind of dumb actor, same kind of sidekick, but instead of Tonto, they had a Chinese cook named Wan Tun. Now what we have to do is change the Tall Stranger into Dick Turpin the Highwayman. We'll make Wan Tun into Kate, a kind of a Maid Marian. You have to have a romantic interest nowadays, and of course the settings have to be changed to period English. And since it's radio, we have to make it visual. We've got something else going for us, Hal went on. He picked up a script and held the first page up for me to look at, pointing to the names of the five writers. The first four were both unknown and unpronounceable, but the name of the fifth, Martin Dixon, I recognized as being one of the highest-paid writers in the world at that time. He was commanding $1 million a script and turning down work. Hal laughed again. He was only a kid at the time, he said. This was his first credit. He worked on 18 of these Tall Strangers. What are they like as scripts, I asked. Hal said he hadn't read them. But his name is money in the bank to us. If we can get the rewriting done fast and we put his name on the covers, we can sell this series in the States without even making a pilot. Shrewd, I said. We got down to work. And we had the first script adapted by lunchtime. I changed the dialogue into the gadzooks type of English which Hal demanded. We got down to casting. What about Linda Fenimore for Kate, said Hal. My face must have indicated some of the nausea evoked by the name of a British star devoid of the basics. Now, Jacko, he said, you must not allow your artistic integrity to erode your business acumen. While I was savouring that marvellous phrase. He reminded me that Linda Fenimore had a boyfriend in the shape of the very substantial shape of 53-year-old Ernie Moncrief. At the time, Ernie was head of a big record company which had diversified into films and owned Penn Park Studios, ideal for the Dick Turpin series. Penn Park Studios, I said. Right, said Hal, at very advantageous terms. I told him I saw the wisdom behind it, but asked him if having Ernie's girlfriend as Kate might be too high a price to pay. Hal shook his head. She's very British, he said, and she has a very British accent. Back in the States, this distracts attention from the performance. You and I know that Fenimore is cold, wooden, and flat-chested, but when the guys at the network hear those fractured barrels, they won't think about the coldness and the woodenness and the poached egg bust. They'll be too busy trying to figure out what the hell she's talking about. I nodded as sagely as I could. I'll call her agent tonight, he went on, so she'll hear about the part before Moncrief does. It'll make her feel good if she thinks she's being offered a job independently of him. Right, I said. There's a first time for everything. What about the male lead? Anyone in mind for Turpin? What do you know about John Ryder? He did that American series, Violent Squad. Came over here and made a couple of features, Dracula in Park Lane and The Ripper of Buckingham Palace. Yes, said Hal, and I happen to know he's in Europe and has a load of tax problems, so he'll need the work. He can ride and does all his own stunts. Well, within days, we'd cast the series. And we'd engaged cameramen, makeup, first assistant, designer, even a director. Since John Ryder was expected to direct his own scenes himself, we were able to economize by engaging an ex-children's program director who had left the BBC under a cloud in the shape of a good-looking parking attendant. It was already September, and the weather was deteriorating, so we decided to do all the location stuff first. Hal hastily made arrangements to use a favorite pub of his near Aylesbury, and then he flew off to New York to finalize contracts with the network, leaving me in charge. You can imagine that I was in a very dynamic mood indeed when the unit assembled at the White Hart for the opening shots of John Ryder leaping out of a bedroom window onto the back of one of the horses Hal had bought at Newmarket. I suppose my dynamic mood lasted about 10 minutes. After that, things started to go wrong, and went from bad to worse. The first problem I had was the telephone wires of the White Hart. Les, our cameraman, explained that there was no angle he could shoot from which would not show them clearly. The landlord of the White Hart not only refused to let us take them down, but got very uppity about the cumbersome equipment the unit had spread around his premises. Then, while I was in his private quarters upstairs discussing these matters and paying out the dropsy we were giving him, I looked out of the window and saw one of our prop men dislodging the pub sign. No sooner was it off its hooks, where it had hung for centuries, than he let it slip and it fell to the ground, splintering into firewood-sized fragments. The publican saw what happened and immediately went puce. I explained that the sign had had to be changed because his pub was standing in for the Spaniards Inn on Hampstead Heath. He asked me why we couldn't shoot there instead of coming all this distance and creating such chaos. I tried to explain, but he merely dug his heels in and demanded another 200 for himself and a new sign for the pub. I told him to whistle for it and threatened to go somewhere else. He said that was all right with him, so I said all right I would. But then he wouldn't let me use his phone to make the necessary arrangements. So I had to walk half a mile down the road to a public phone. And while I was there, John Ryder persuaded the barman to open the bar and start serving drinks. So Ryder himself and most of the unit were pretty far gone by the time I got back. We couldn't get to the alternative location in time to start the same day, so we lost 10 out of 10 shooting hours on the very first day. I went home very depressed. Next day was no better. To begin with, Linda Fenimore was a first-degree disaster as Kate. I've already told you she was cold, wooden, and without any trace of histrionic talent, but she also had a few other things that weren't going for her. She was 8 inches taller than John Ryder, even when he was wearing specially built-up boots. Consequently, he had to stand on a little platform whenever they played a scene together, though this arrangement was sometimes changed in favour of Linda standing in a specially dug hole. Added to this was the time she spent fitting her front teeth with caps, which she could only wear when the cameras were turning, because after a few minutes they made her lips swell, and not being a natural blonde, her hair had to be lightened every day, and she couldn't be photographed from the right side because there were still traces of the cosmetic operation she'd had done on her nose, and her contact lenses had to be removed at frequent intervals or her eyes watered. Added to these crippling burdens were the fact that, one, she was allergic to John Ryder, and, two, she was losing her sexual grip on our studio landlord Ernie Moncrief, whose wife was rumoured to have had her bust lifted. In spite of these setbacks, we struggled on. I don't think I've ever worked so hard in my life in an attempt to complete the 13 episodes before our studio deal with Ernie Moncrief came to an end. Hal didn't spend time at the studio himself. Apart from a couple of trips to Newmarket, he also went to the horse sales in Dublin, and from there over to the States to confer with the TV network, which had put up the money for the Dick Turpin show, with options for 1,274 more, if the first batch worked out. He never wrote or phoned me about how these negotiations were going. All I got was a postcard from Kentucky, which described the weather there and requested me to give his love to all the boys and girls on the unit, most of whom did not even recognise the name Hal Minchintrope when I passed the message on. Then, during the 7th week, while he was still in the States, I received a phone call from New York. The caller gave his name as Alvin Fillmore. He explained that he was the vice president of the network involved in the Dick Turpin show. I asked him if he'd seen the rushes which I'd been sending over each week and which I had personally taken to air freight at Heathrow every Friday. "Forget the rushes," he said. "I want the figures. I want to know how much you've spent to date. I want to know the total figure, not a breakdown of your expenses. I want to know how much you owe. In other words, I want to know what this project is costing as of now." Well, I minimized the amount as much as I could because I didn't want him to feel it was discouragingly expensive. He said, "Are you sure we're not in above that?" I told him I was sure. "Right," he said, "you'll be hearing from us." And then he hung up without even saying goodbye. I went back on the set feeling a bit shaken. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, tempers were frayed, and I was almost relieved when I was told there was a solicitor in reception who wanted a personal word with me. It meant a break from the mounting tension on the floor. Off I went to meet Mr. Roxburgh of Hill and Howe. He introduced himself and handed me an expensively printed card. He told me he represented the American network. It was then that the substance we don't mention on the radio really hit the fan. Everything was cancelled. All employees were given notice of the termination of their contracts, and all agreements were rendered null and void. Bang, bang, bang. An hour later, though it seemed longer, the shouting and the hysterics were over. The unit disbanded, muttering threats and recriminations. At last, all was quiet. I sat in my office, gulping down a large malt and reflecting on the precarious nature of the business I'd gone into with such high hopes. There was a tap on the door. I held my breath and sat perfectly still, hoping that whoever it was would give up and go away. But no, the door opened. A face peered round. It was Burley, the horsey friend of Hal's I'd met at his club. "Just call for the horses," he said. "How's tricks?" "How's tricks?" I said, rhetorically. "I don't know what you mean. And what's this about the horses?" "Hal asked me to collect them," he said, and he glanced pointedly at the bottle I was holding prior to helping myself to another health-giving slug. "Hal asked you to collect them," I said, playing for time. "I got this cable this morning," he said. "Came straight away. Hope I'm not too late." He handed me a full-rate cable, dispatched from New York the previous evening. It read, "Collect horses from Penn Park and stable them at Newmarket until further notice stop. Warmest greetings, Minchintrope." Well, I didn't waste time or malt whiskey on Burley. I merely phoned through to the studio stables where the various black messes were kept and gave instructions for them to be handed over. Burley merely smirked and went away whistling in a cheerful manner which grated on my nerves, as was, I am sure, his intention. I helped myself to one for the road and went home. I slept late next day and was awakened by a messenger pushing a cable through my letterbox. It was from Hal, en route to Heathrow, and instructed me to meet him at his house at 2:30. I prepared myself for trouble. I needn't have bothered. At 2:30, Hal was in a very cheerful mood, well nigh ebullient. "Easy come, easy go," he said. "That's the way the cookie crumbles. I want to give you a word of advice," he said. "Yes," I said. "You were phoned and asked how much the series was costing, weren't you?" he said. I nodded. "What they wanted to know," he went on, "was how much it would cost them not to make any more episodes." I looked at him. The penny was beginning to drop. "They'd seen the rushes," he said, "and whenever the boys at head office see the rushes of a series or a big picture, whatever it is, they're depressed. They don't like what they see. Doesn't measure up to their expectations. They ask each other how much it will cost them to get out." "It wasn't so much," I said. "I tried to keep it down as much as I could." "That was your mistake," he said. "You should have sworn on your mother's grave that you'd spend $1.5 million, and then they would have let you go ahead. It's very important, always remember this, to spend a lot of money at the start of a project like ours. Get them all in up to here," he tapped his Adam's apple. "That's the only way to handle accountants." The penny had by then really dropped. It all seemed clear to me. My spirits sank so low that I felt I should never feel smart again. "Sorry I can't ask you to stay," said Hal, "but I'm off to Newmarket this afternoon. Must see Burley about those horses." I got up, shook hands, and tottered away. Weeks later, I heard, quite by chance, that Hal had made $500,000 out of the various black messes he'd bought for the series. He sold them in Kentucky at a huge profit, and two of them had distinguished careers in American classics. Afterwards, they went to stud, where they earned their syndicate astronomic sums. The syndicate was, of course, the Hal Minchintrope Syndicate. All the profits went into his numbered account in Switzerland. What Dick Turpin himself took from people on stagecoaches was peanuts to what Hal took out of that series. You have to admire a man like that. I wonder if any of my listeners remember a British B-picture called Soho Wife. Well, it doesn't really matter whether you remember it or not. It wasn't, in fact, memorable. I happened to be the first assistant for the tests, not the actual picture. Most of the poor unfortunates who took part in these tests were doomed to fail because the American producer, Cass Essling, had engaged a lighting cameraman named Desmond Farrington and a makeup man named Eddie Watts. They didn't get on. Well, that's an understatement. I don't know how to describe their mutual dislike, but from the very first moment of meeting, Desmond and Eddie brought out the very worst in each other, and this quickly escalated into a life-and-death struggle. Desmond, the cameraman, was normally a quiet and efficient worker who smoked a pipe and always wore pullovers and socks knitted by his wife, Jill. He spent his weekends putting up shelves, mowing the lawn and making a patio, that sort of thing. As I close my eyes, I can see the two of them now sitting on the settee, sipping Ovaltine and looking at each other, smiling and now and again smoothing a crease or picking a speck of dust off the other's homemade cardigan. They were a really gruesome couple. But nevertheless, Desmond was a good cameraman, unimaginative but sound and reliable. Eddie was also reliable, a real pro, but his character was very different. In his own words, Eddie was a well-adjusted sex maniac. He was always talking about sex. With Eddie, there was no other subject of conversation. When he was with a woman, whatever the circumstance, time or place, Eddie would kick off with some remark like, "Are you getting plenty of what's good for girls?" Or, "Can I do anything for you?" Or even, "Where have you been all my life?" I can't remember him ever saying anything clever or original. I mean, when the tea lady came round the studio, Eddie would take his tea and hand over the money with a suggestive wink and some remark like, "There's only one thing nicer than a cup of tea. Aren't you going to ask them what it is?" And this was the tea lady, who looked like a Russian general. In his makeup room, he would keep up a running monologue for the benefit of his captive audience in the chair. "Your eyes, no need to ask what you were doing last night. No, don't move. Keep still while I touch you up with this little brush. I hope you don't think I'm rude. You don't, do you? Or perhaps you'd like me to be rude. Some do, you know. Oh, you quiet ones are often the worst. Just talk, you may think." Not a bit of it. The fact was that Eddie had the most active and varied sex life of any man or woman I have ever known, including Errol Flynn, of whom more some other week. Considering he'd had 3 heart attacks, it was nothing short of miraculous. They seemed to have made no difference, except perhaps to make him anxious to cram as much action into his life as he could before he had a 4th. The amazing thing was that this chatting up technique of his frequently worked. Yes, most of these puerile and one-sided conversations Eddie had with the opposite sex led to live action. Apart from the casual brief encounters, Eddie had about 6 regular sexual partners, and among them were 3 extras who only visited the studios when they were on call for a film. Eddie was very efficient about keeping track of which days the various girls were likely to be working, and when one of them was called, she and Eddie usually retired to one of the dressing rooms and spent the lunch hour, and sometimes tea breaks as well, in pleasures of the flesh. Valerie, one of his favourite extras, was married to an unfaithful husband, and she really slept with Eddie for reasons of revenge. Diana, another favourite, was married to a physical culture fanatic whose ambition was to become Mr. Universe. Night after night he spent lifting weights and stretching steel springs and drawing in his stomach muscles until his intestines were visible from the outside, and night after night Diana failed to persuade him to share the fruits of his efforts. In the course of conversation with Eddie, she felt uninhibited enough to reveal this unsatisfactory marital situation, with the result that Eddie was able to compensate her for her muscle-bound husband's neglect. There were plenty of other regulars, including Ailsa, a fun-loving Australian extra, and Corinne, a local barmaid. Eddie was married, and, so far as I know, he and his wife lived together. Eddie never mentioned her or their mutual home. This was perhaps the most glaring difference between him and Desmond, who was always raving on about his home-loving wife and the semi-detached love nest of which he was so sickeningly proud. To put it crudely, this got up Eddie's nose, and Eddie's lewd attitude to the female sex triggered off Desmond's pent-up aggression. In the ordinary way, this would not have mattered to anyone else. The fact that Desmond and Eddie had made unspoken declarations of war on each other would not have mattered. Unfortunately, the two protagonists I'm describing made the fatal decision to fight each other on the battleground of the artist's faces. In other words, Desmond started using very unflattering lighting arrangements in the close-ups and blaming the resultant bad pictures on Eddie's makeup. Eddie, in his turn, started playing tricks with the makeup, so that when Cass Essling complained about an artist's appearance, he could claim that it was all the fault of the appalling lighting arranged by Desmond. I was at my wit's end. There seemed no solution short of sacking one of them, which I would have done like a shot, but relations between the union and Cass Essling were already strained, and I knew they'd not wear the dismissal of one of their senior members. It was a first assistant's nightmare. I knew I was in the hot seat. One day Cass Essling sent for me. As soon as I entered his office, he grabbed me by both lapels. He had a long cigar in his mouth, which he pushed into my face. "You are the first assistant," he shouted. I nodded, and I tried to dodge the glowing cigar within inches of my nose. "Either Eddie or Desmond has got to go fast. It's up to you. Get rid of one of them. I don't care which." "Okay, Cass," I said, and his grip slackened. "Leave it to me." Without another word, he released me and strode away. No doubt experiencing that warm glow of satisfaction that always comes from shifting responsibility onto someone in an inferior position who can't talk back. That night I went home and hurried up to my bachelor flat and the unmade bed and unwashed breakfast things which had been there since I'd got up 16 hours previously when I'd been awoken by the sound of the couple next door having a row. This was my first time as first assistant, and I wanted to be taken on when they finished the tests and started making the actual film. It meant a lot to me. I shut my eyes, but my brain raced on. How could I get rid of Eddie? Or Desmond? That is what I kept asking myself over and over again. One of them had to go. Hour after hour, I tossed and turned, and it seemed to me that I'd considered every possible means except murder. By 2 o'clock in the morning, I was no nearer a solution, and so I decided to try and go to sleep in the hope that a nap might refresh the grey matter and help me to solve my problem. As soon as I'd made this decision, bang on cue, the couple next door arrived home and proceeded to make up the quarrel they disturbed me with in the early hours of the previous day. The normal sexual jealousy I felt soon found expression in the way I banged on the wall with a waste bin. But this didn't deter the amorous couple for a moment. Serves him right, I thought to myself, if he has a heart attack. That was the precise moment the solution to my problem came to me. I didn't bother to work out the details. I knew I could do that during breakfast or on my way to the studios. Enough for the moment to have an overall plan. It was a good feeling after so much worry. I sighed happily and went to sleep. I woke up refreshed and confident. At breakfast, I started working out details of the plan I had in mind to dispose of Eddie. Yes, Eddie was to be the victim. Of the two, I would have preferred to dispose of Desmond, but it was just the luck of the game that the solution I found didn't involve him. But no point in concealing it from you any longer. I planned that Eddie should collapse as a result of sexual excesses. Now, relax. No cause to write complaining letters to the Radio Times. I'm not going to give a graphic description of what went on. That's not relevant to the story, which is a story of survival. Mine. In order to get rid of Eddie, I planned to arrange for at least 3 of his girlfriends to visit him at the studio in quick succession. Although it was so early, I made a phone call to Valerie, who, you may remember, slept with Eddie for reasons of revenge. She knew I was in pictures and so was not too surprised to hear from me at such an early hour. just to make sure she was in the right mood to revenge herself, I made an innocent-sounding inquiry about her husband. Her reply sounded as though it was spoken through clenched teeth. I could tell from the breathy sounds which followed that Valerie would arrive at the studios in exactly the right mood to push Eddie to the limit. I made a similar call to Diana, married to the Mr. Universe aspirant, and arranged for her to be at the studios at 11. In between the two girls being there, I planned to keep him very busy with his normal job of making up the artists. By the time I had to leave for the studios, I'd arranged for Eddie's third sexual partner of the day to arrive at 2 in the afternoon, this girl called Ailsa. She'd not had a studio call for 6 months or so, and told me she was thinking of giving up the business. "Don't do that," I said, "you'd break Eddie's heart." "Eddie," she said, "who's Eddie?" "You remember Eddie," I said, "Eddie Makeup." "Oh, that Eddie." There was a quick change of gear. "Yes, I remember him all right. Will he be there?" "Yes, Ailsa," I said, "he certainly will. You can have a nice lunch hour with him." "Lovely, whole hour." And she hung up with a gurgle of anticipation. Valerie, Diana and Ailsa. Not a bad menu, I reflected. Valerie arrived at 9. I was very charming to her and made up a story explaining the test was cancelled, but that, of course, I should see that she was not out of pocket. She was delighted out of all proportion. It was out of proportion because she'd seen Eddie approaching. "Is this girl annoying you, sir?" he chose as his opening gambit and slid his arm round her waist. "She's a naughty girl, this is. At least I hope so." I told him I shouldn't be needing anything from make-up for an hour or so. I could feel his eyes meet Valerie's, and in a moment he was leading her away in the direction of the star dressing room. One up and 2 to go, I thought to myself. As I walked behind the set towards my office, Desmond spotted me. He was wearing a new sweater with bobbles. He ran after me and started to moan about the previous day's tests. "Impossible to light," he said, his usual cry. "I know the problems, Desmond, but you're doing miracles," I said. "Miracles." And he walked away with a smug smile. When Eddie reappeared, I was pleased to notice that his hands were trembling and he was breathing very heavily. "Ah, Eddie," I said nonchalantly, "I just want to put you in the picture regarding the tests we're doing later this morning." "Good heavens," I deftly interrupted myself, "is that really the time? It's later than I thought." I told him about Diana Needham arriving. "Diana Needham?" he said. "Yes, I know I can rely on you, bearing in mind the lack of cooperation from the lighting department. You've done miracles on these tests," I said. "Miracles." What the hell, I was thinking, if he's going, he might as well go happy. Eddie murmured his appreciation, and he hurried off. 10 minutes later, I saw him escorting Valerie down the drive towards the front gate. 50 minutes later, Diana had done her test, one of the worst in living memory. After it was over, I saw Eddie slip her the key to number 5 room and whisper something in her ear which brought an anticipatory smile to her sensuous lips. I turned a blind eye. I knew I had to appear unaware of what was happening so that when I achieved the result I was aiming at, no blame could ever be attached to me. I didn't fancy being tagged a murderer, even though the blunt instrument I'd chosen was of a pleasure-giving nature. I contrived for Eddie to be called onto the set a couple of times to repair makeup, and this, I knew, would add to the stress and strain. Each time he appeared, his eyes were a little redder, and the trembling in his hands had spread to his knees. Fine, I thought, and Ailsa still to come, let alone Corinne, the barmaid. I decided to line the latter up just in case she might be needed, and so I repaired to the adjacent pub. There she was, larger than life, chatting to an undersized estate agent, who was actually standing on the rail in order to get a better view down her blouse. As soon as she saw me, she sidled over, leaving him to climb down sheepishly and leak a bit of his aggression by stuffing his fag out in the Dr. Bernardo's box on the bar. I bought Corinne a snowball and chatted amicably about the booming leisure industries before I invited her to pop into the studios around tea time and watch the tests. I only mentioned Eddie in passing because, as you know, I hoped that with any luck he would be in an oxygen tent at the local hospital by the time she arrived. So I gave her arm a meaningful squeeze and hurried back to the studio in time to interrupt Eddie and Diana once more before lunch. Back in the office, I sent for Eddie. This time he took appreciably longer to arrive and looked very much the worse for wear. "Sorry, Eddie," I said, offhandedly, "but I have to do another test. I've got Ailsa Drummond coming along shortly." Eddie groaned and rested both hands on the edge of my desk as he took a deep restorative breath. At that moment I saw a taxi turn into the drive, and out of it stepped Ailsa. Eddie had not seen her because he was still leaning on my desk with his eyes closed, breathing. "Why, there's Ailsa in the drive now," I said. "Ailsa?" he blurted out as he lurched over to the window. Then he raised his left hand to his chest and pulled a face. "It's the old ticker," he said. "I think I'd better lie down for a bit." I realized immediately that Eddie had in mind just plain avoiding Ailsa. I reacted fast to scotch this ruse and rapped on the window. Ailsa, having paid the taxi, looked up and saw the two of us there. She blew Eddie a kiss. I beckoned her to come up. Eddie gave a little moan. I knew Diana was still in number 5 dressing room, and I didn't want to risk Ailsa finding out, so I told Eddie he could have a brief lie down for medicinal purposes, and he nodded gratefully and dragged himself upstairs. Meanwhile, Ailsa came up to my office, and I was pleased to note that she was obviously in the peak of condition gland-wise, and that the chances were that she would finish Eddie off without me having recourse to Corinne, the huge Bristol barmaid from the White Hart. I was about to tell her I hoped she'd have a nice lunch hour with the accent on the hour when I spotted Eddie trudging down the drive again, this time to bid Diana farewell. I watched him embrace her bravely, and then I saw an excited third assistant grab Eddie by the arm and hustle him back to the set. What now? I thought, as I reminded myself that the business of the unit was still going on and that I'd better go down and keep abreast. I took Ailsa down with me, told her to wait in the hall, and plunged into a screaming match led by Desmond and Eddie. It was the same old story. Desmond was accusing Eddie of neglecting his work, and Eddie was protesting that Desmond's lighting was inadequate, and actually pointed up to a spotlight and criticised the angle and power of it. This brought out the veins in Desmond's forehead, and he screamed blue murder. I sent Eddie out of the studio. "Go to my office," I said, knowing that he'd step through the door straight into the hungry arms of Ailsa, who was in the hall waiting. Having given them time to renew acquaintance, I suggested to the second assistant and the rest that we take our lunch break early, and they agreed. The bell was rung, and I heaved a sigh of relief. I made soothing noises to Desmond and told him what miracles he was achieving, and was quite shocked when he started screaming at me about Eddie's unprofessional behaviour in shapes of Valerie and Diana. I couldn't resist fanning the flames, adding to Desmond's sense of outrage by refusing to believe what he was telling me. My disbelief made Desmond positively apoplectic, and on this note of high-pitched hysteria, I left him to have a quiet lunch on a tray in my office. I had barely time to trim the curled edge off the slice of tongue which accompanied the tired lettuce when I heard shouting and running footsteps from the other corridor. "Get matron," I heard someone shouting. "Phone for an ambulance." "Good old Eddie," I said to myself. I raised my glass of lager. I felt I could afford the luxury of a moment of sentiment. What a lovely way to die. I decided to ignore the hue and cry. Why upset myself, I thought. Let nature take its course. After 10 minutes of shouting, running footsteps and bells ringing, I was relieved to see an ambulance turn into the drive and stop at the main entrance. I finished the lager and went down to bid my last respects to Eddie. I got down to the hall in time to see two attendants carry a stretcher towards the front door and the waiting ambulance. I half expected to see a tearful Ailsa walking beside the horizontal figure, but no, it was unaccompanied. I stepped towards it, murmuring, "Eddie," and trying to keep the success out of my voice. The leading attendant looked at me. "Who's Eddie?" he said. I looked back at him, not understanding. Then I looked down at the form on the stretcher. I twisted my head to catch the face square on. It wasn't Eddie. It was Desmond. Nothing happened for several seconds. It was like Robinson Crusoe seeing the footprint in the sand. At last, I said lamely, I meant Desmond. Just for a moment I thought I'd incriminated myself, but I soon recovered and was able to act in a way that passed for normal. What happened? I asked. Heart, said the ambulance man, but I think he'll be all right, so long as we don't hang about. Must get him proper attention. Still shaken, I leaned against the wall and tried to collect myself. I closed my eyes. In a moment or so, a familiar voice gave me a nasty shock. It was Eddie, and he had sidled up to me silently in a very characteristic way. He was taking a peek, Desmond was, he said, at the keyhole. He's a voyeur, that's what he is, would you believe it? I didn't argue with him. I dare say Desmond was a voyeur, but I think envy of Eddie also had something to do with it. Anyway, so far as I was concerned, it had solved my immediate problem. In case any of you are interested in what happened to Desmond, he recovered. After a few days in hospital, he went home and slipped easily into the role of the perfectly fit semi-invalid which his wife had always wanted. So all ended happily. Cass Essling was happy, though not exactly appreciative. All he said to me was, "You were lucky there, Jacko, very lucky." Well, I suppose I was. What Cass didn't know was that Corinne was waiting for me in one of the star dressing rooms, and I was fairly confident she'd show me all the appreciation I could wish.
I haven't taken part in many TV commercials. If I had, I should be in a very different financial situation than the one I'm in at the moment. It's true that in the early days of independent television, I took a leading role in one for Gravy Browning. It won a prize for the direction. I had to eat quantities of the product and give the impression that I was enjoying it and couldn't get enough. That required acting of a very high order. But alas, no Oscar for yours truly, and no follow-up jobs. Just when I'd about given up, I had a call from my agent's secretary. She told me to be at the office of a small film company, Culver City Pictures of Soho, at 11:13 the following day. The girl didn't have any details of the type of role I was being considered for. She didn't know the name of the product or where the commercial would be shot or who was directing. I asked her a few questions and she replied that she wasn't on Mastermind and hung up on me. I phoned Culver City Pictures and asked them. They revealed that they were planning a commercial for Tasty tea bags, but gave no details. They said it was all terribly hush-hush. This usually means that they don't know themselves. But to me, the product sounded appealing as a vehicle. I visualized sitting down, drinking a cup of tea, and smiling and nodding, even winking towards the camera, and then collecting my check. That would have suited me perfectly. I turned up at the office a few minutes ahead of time. A crowd of 20 or 30 was already there. I had a nodding acquaintance with one or two of the others present, and gleaned from them that the company were casting athletic types for a swimming pool sequence. I looked round at some of the broken-down character men assembled and decided that this couldn't be wholly true. Either that or the casting director was having a nervous breakdown, a fairly common occupational hazard. Most of the old lads were beyond the age and quite unsuitable for aquatic sports. I had to admit to myself that I was of their number. A stunt man I recognised came in and I asked him what he knew. He told me they were looking for people who could make a 60-foot dive into a small tank and that the rest of us might as well pack it in and go home. He was obviously trying to eliminate the competition, and I decided to hang on and find out for myself. It was a tedious wait. A few more actors arrived, and I noticed one in particular, Frank Moffat. He was a weedy little man with a rat-like face. I gave him a wave, and he nodded back across the crowded room. If he's in with a chance, I thought to myself, then there's still hope for me. Presently, a young advertising type bustled in from the street and pushed aside the people round the door. "Excuse me," he said, "Mr. Willis has arrived. Let Mr. Willis through, please." In came Mr. Willis. This was sensational. It was Sam Willis, the sight of whom sent a shiver through the frames of every actor who recognised him. He was a notorious bully, sarcastic, hectoring, known for his ability to reduce the strongest performer to a blubbering pulp. Overweight and dressed like a country gentleman of the Edwardian period, he strode in, looking neither to right nor left. I remember thinking that if they ever made a picture based on the life of Mussolini, Sam Willis was the man for the part. He pushed the young man ahead of him, using him as a sort of battering ram to get through the crowd. Within seconds, he was on the other side of the room and had opened the door without knocking and disappeared inside. The door slammed behind him. 7 or 8 of the actors got up and left without a word. Those remaining started chattering excitedly. Was this notorious director of big-time movies actually going to direct a commercial? It seemed unbelievable that his talents for handling crowds and spectacular effects could ever be harnessed to 30 seconds of film devoted to tea bags. Frank Moffat made his way over. "Ever worked with him before, Jacko?" he asked. "No," I said. "Have you?" "Twice. I think I have a very good chance." The inner door opened and a voice said, "All right, who's first?" A good-looking young actor put away his racing paper and went in. There was a count of 2 and he came out again. It was as if he'd walked round a revolving door. He shook his head at the rest of us and left without a word. "Next," said the same voice. There was a pause. The interview, if you can call it that, had been so swift, no one was sure whose turn it was to go in. Sam Willis appeared at the door. "Haven't got all day," he shouted. "You, girl, I want to get through this tedious business as soon as possible. If you can't keep the flow moving, get out and find someone who can." I could see the tears come to the girl's eyes. Sam Willis slammed the door. An actor went towards it, knocked, and went in. Like his predecessor, he was only inside for a second or two. Out he came, white and shaking. Eventually, it was my turn. Sam Willis was standing a few feet inside the room. Behind him were the client, the agency people, the creative team, and so forth. Sam looked at his list. Then he looked at me. "Better," he said. "You are J.K. Platt?" "That's right, Mr. Willis," I said, managing not to stammer. "Are you available July 7th? "Yes." "Right. Here, try this on." He handed me a large cushion-like piece of padding. It was really 2 cushions joined along one side and with a hole in the top. I looked at it for a moment to figure out exactly how it was supposed to be worn. This irritated Willis. He snatched it out of my hands and rammed it over my head. It was like the life belts they have on airplanes. There were 2 tapes to tie at the side. "It won't bite you," he said. "It's a tasty tea bag." There were murmurs of protest from the others. All right," he said. "It's not a tasty tea bag. It's a tea bag of some rival and inferior brand. We want 7 or 8 or so unappetizing people to portray them. You look perfect to me, a hangdog expression and a suit that looks as if it's been slept in." He turned to the others. "All agreed?" They all nodded and said things like perfect and fabulous. An American said, "Neat." "Good, we'll be in touch with your agent. Next, please. Go on, man, move." I was hustled out before I had a chance to ask for details. I passed Frank Moffat, who was on his way in. I gave him the thumbs-up sign. As he entered and the door closed behind me, I heard Willis bellow, "Another one, perfect." I didn't wait. I waved enigmatically to my acquaintances who were waiting to be seen and walked off in the direction of the Dog and Glue Pot. I fancied a glass of real ale. I was sipping it quietly in a corner and conjecturing on the size of fee my agent might get for my services when in came Frank. He didn't see me, so I waited until he'd ordered his drink before I strolled over and inquired if congratulations were in order. "I think so," he said, "but you never know till you've signed the contract, do you?" I agreed and asked if he knew where we would be likely to be doing it. He didn't. All he knew was that he was a mean little teabag and I was a depressed, lackluster teabag, and that the teabag that made the steaming hot cup of tasty tea was none other than Fiona Gale. "None other?" I asked. It was a name new to me. "She was a Page 3 girl a month ago. They signed her up for this right away. To be a teabag." "Right. She's making an LP, and they say she's going to be on Wogan." "Talent will out," I said. "By the way, how's your leg?" Frank looked at me angrily. "What leg, Jacko? What are you talking about?" "I thought you were in an accident, pushed off a bus or something. You were limping badly last time I saw you. You must be thinking of someone else." "I remember distinctly it was in Drury Lane." "Buses don't go down Drury Lane." "I mean, when I saw you, you were limping. You said you'd been pushed off a bus in Brighton." "You must be thinking of someone else." "You mean you've never been pushed off a bus?" "Of course I do. You think I'm the type that gets pushed off buses? I may be of slight build, but any time you want to get into the ring with me down at the gym, I'll show you a few tricks." "You mean you box, Frank?" "Of course I do. You want me to prove it?" "I've never been into that sort of thing." "Then you want to be careful who you accuse of being pushed off buses."
I'm certainly sorry. I accept your apology, but it so happens that I'm a keep fit fanatic down at the gym every day, couple of hours workout. The instructor says I have the body of a 30-year-old. How old are you, Frank? I could give you a year or so, Jacko. Well, you look well, I'll say that. Care for another? No, thank you. One is my limit. I watch my diet, too, you know. Yes, well, I think I'll watch mine. I put down my empty glass. Very wise. He looked at his watch. Now I must be off to meet a friend of mine. We're playing squash at one. I looked impressed. By the way, Jacko, if and when we meet on this commercial, I hope you won't make the same mistake you made just now. Just remember it was someone else you were thinking about. I've never had any leg trouble or any other. I'm 100% fit, and don't you forget it. With that, he strode off. I decided to risk my health by having the other half. As I sipped it, I reflected on what Frank had said. It baffled me. I was certain it had been him I'd met limping at the side of Drury Lane. We'd had a brief conversation about the old days when Ivan Novello had been in residence at the old place, and how Frank, as a young actor, had been in his production of Henry V, a disaster. Ivor's public missed the music, Shakespeare's public missed the acting. And now, comparatively late in life, Frank had become a health freak. But then one gets used to these inexplicable surprises in show business. In fact, it's nothing but surprises half the time. The Olivier's divorce, Herbert Wilcox's bankruptcy, the decline of Jack Buchanan, the meteoric rise of Charles Aznavour. Who could ever have anticipated them? Still, I suppose it makes for a bit of excitement and accounts for the fact that nobody ever really gives up hope. Any day that big break may come along. After all, I'd switched that very morning from being unemployed to being an actor who was to star as a teabag and likely to earn in a day what was well above the income of a greengrocer. As it turned out, my agent accepted a fee which was less than the lowest I'd anticipated. He claimed, of course, to have persuaded them to pay much more than they'd planned. I arrived at the studios at 7 on the appointed day. It allowed 2 hours for the fitting of the teabag. That was accomplished in about 5 minutes. Once it was sewn on securely, I wandered down to the set to see what was happening. There, in the centre of the studio, was a huge teapot, 16 feet high. I should say 3/4 of a teapot, because a big section of the side was cut out, and I could see that it contained a big airbag. 2 or 3 feet above the open top, it had no lid, there was a short diving board reached by some steps with a handrail at either side. An electrician explained that the actors playing teabags were going to stand on the board and then drop, on cue, into the teapot. At that moment, the property men wheeled in a giant kettle, and with a lot of fuss and overacting, they managed to sling it from the roof and place it in position above the teapot. I went back to the dressing room I was sharing with 3 other teabags. I found 2 very old actors, both wearing the same type of bag I was. They told me they were old, used teabag and underfilled teabag, respectively. The latter's bag had very little padding and flopped around his hips like a miniskirt. We were soon joined by Frank Moffat. He was carrying his teabag and told us we were in for a long wait and there was no need to get into costume until Fiona Gale arrived and was made up and ready. I remembered how touchy Frank had been about his health. I didn't make the same mistake again. "In superb condition as usual, Frank?" I inquired. "Perfect. And professionally, things are looking very good for me just now. A film in Rome due to start next month, then a TV series, and after that another movie, probably in Yugoslavia. I may have to move to a tax haven." I saw one of the old hands wink at the other. They were as used to this sort of big talk as I was, though not from Frank Moffat. In our last 2 encounters, he seemed to have undergone a personality change. I asked my roommates if they knew who were playing the other teabags. Frank shook his head and said they were being played by unknowns. We explained were the really important teabags, and of the 4 of us, his was the key role. He'd been chosen as the teabag who contrasted most dramatically with the genuine tasty teabag played by Fiona Gale. The 3rd assistant called in and asked if we were all ready. We asked him what was going on. He explained that Fiona Gale was creating a scene in the wardrobe department. Her father was not happy about her costume. Having exploited her natural attributes in topless photographs in newspapers, he didn't want her to wear the giant teabag provided, as it would be throwing away her biggest assets. But Sam Willis was not standing any nonsense from this upstart, who, until his daughter had reached the age of consent, had been an unemployed fairground barker.
Sam reminded them both that they knew what she was in for when she signed the contract, and that, unlike all the other tea bags, hers had been specially made by a designer of royal wedding dresses, and was costing more than she was. This had aggravated Fiona's father, and he'd threatened to walk out. Sam had said, "Don't walk, I'll call you a taxi." Fiona had told her father not to be ridiculous and had offered to fix the tea bag herself if someone had let her have a needle and thread. While the third assistant was telling us all this, Frank seized the opportunity to lie on the floor and do press-ups. "Limbering up," as he put it. The third assistant said he didn't think the action would require much effort. It was still more difficult than stepping off a bus. But Frank insisted that you couldn't be too careful when it came to stunts for the movies. I thought stunts was pushing it a bit. Just as we were all relaxing and beginning to think in terms of getting through until lunchtime without doing a stroke of work, thereby increasing the possibility of running into a second day, we were called down to the set. The first assistant explained to the 12 tea bags assembled that Mr. Willis, who sat silently glaring at us, was going to shoot out of sequence until various problems had been ironed out. First shot would be the tea bags jumping into the teapot in reverse order, so that the film could be played backwards and they would appear to be jumping out, having been rejected or ejected by the teapot, which could distinguish a tasty tea bag from any other. This meant that Frank would jump first and I would follow. We got into position, the rest of the tea bags behind us. At this point, Sam decided that the first assistant was being long-winded, and so he interrupted him. "I want a quick run up the steps, along the board, and then a pause until I tell you to jump. Right, camera. Running. Clappers at the end. Action," he shouted in parade ground style. Frank reached up to the handrail and put his right foot on the lowest rung. He paused and said something. I couldn't hear what it was. He leaned backwards towards me and repeated it more or less in my ear. "We should have resin on these rungs. Slippery." I looked at the ladder. The rungs had been covered in a sort of non-slip rubber material and looked okay to me. I didn't have a chance to say so before Frank continued. "You heard me, didn't you, Jacko? But they've deliberately ignored my warning." "Action!" repeated Sam Willis with a style of voice production not heard anywhere since the Nuremberg Rally of 1936. Frank mounted the ladder as far as the third rung. I was on the first one when he appeared to lose his footing. I gripped both handrails and leaned forward, thus providing a support to steady him. "You know what he whispered to me? Mind your own bloody business." Well, I hadn't exactly saved his life or anything, but I believed I had prevented what might have been a nasty fall. I was about to say so when he gave my right hand a vicious kick. I let go of the handrail and Frank slipped again. This time he fell to the floor with a blood-curdling scream. It was high-pitched, ear-piercing, tumbler-breaking. If Hammer Films could have recorded it, it would have had pride of place in their sound library. I stepped down and pushed back the tea bag who was immediately behind me. I heard Frank gasp. He lay on the floor, writhing. People ran towards him from all directions. There were calls for first aid, for a stretcher, for matron, but one voice rose above all the rest, Sam Willis's. "Get a replacement for that clumsy oaf!" I knelt down beside Frank and loosened his tea bag. It was only a matter of 3 seconds at most before he murmured, "I'm losing consciousness." But in that brief moment he managed to blurt out that he'd warned them of the danger, the need for resin, that he was in superb physical condition, and that his lucrative future was blighted as a result of their carelessness. He showed remarkable presence of mind in getting over these facts so cogently, considering the pain he appeared to be in. Appeared is right, of course. It hit me in a flash, much later than it should have done. He'd set it all up. He'd established his fitness with all the I-dotting and T-crossing precision of a master dramatist. He left nothing to chance. The painful kick I'd sustained was the only giveaway to the deception. A cameraman administered first aid and someone called an ambulance. Willis disappeared to his office to phone for a replacement and, no doubt, have a word with his insurance broker to see what he was likely to be in for. When he came back, he was accompanied by Fiona Gale, who looked pale and unhappy, and her father was tight-lipped and beady-eyed. There appeared to have been an argument. They went straight to the ladder. "Go on, up you get," said Willis. Fiona whimpered. "It's 6 steps. A child could do it," said her father. Fiona started to cry. "That poor man fell," she blurted out. "He hurt himself. I'm frightened." Naturally, she was unnerved by Willis's manner more than anything.
so different from the fawning still photographers she'd worked for previously. I mean, making your film debut under Sam Willis was like starting a naval career under Captain Bligh of the Bounty. He made no allowances, nor did her father, who I'd heard was taking 90% of everything she earned and had formed himself into a limited company. "You're a silly bitch," shouted Willis. "Look at me." With that, he gripped the handrail and started to mount the steps. He was obviously seething, and the veins on his forehead were bulging dangerously. He was breathing like an angry bull. As his left foot hit the fourth step, it slipped. He lost his balance. Involuntarily, he pulled at the handrail so that his body came closer to the ladder. His head was pushed forward. The result of this was that his whole weight was suddenly suspended by his chin on the sixth step. Blood spurted from his mouth. He'd bitten his tongue. Fiona screamed. No one else made a sound. I didn't actually see anyone smile, but I doubt if there was anyone in that studio, except Fiona and her father, who didn't silently applaud this providential demonstration of natural justice. It was enough to make even the most cynical wonder if, perhaps, after all, there was not some destiny that shapes our ends. Before the ambulance was called, even before the cameraman was able to repeat his first aid gesture, Fiona's father gave her a savage belt on the shoulder and hissed, "Now look what you've done!" I feel sure that her later decision to leave home and find herself an agent was really made at that moment. There was a lot of murmuring and whispering among the crew and the actors, and the ambulance eventually arrived to take Willis to an expensive nursing home. The beauty of it was that he was quite unable to speak and consequently couldn't give any instructions as to what anyone was to do. After a conference, the producer and the agency men agreed to cancel the production. We were all sent home, and later paid in full. But they didn't try to shoot it again with live actors. They made an animated version, using Fiona Gale at the very end, just to smile as a tasty tea bag jumped into the pot and stayed there. She wasn't able to actually speak the end line. They had to get an actress to say, "Tasty tea bags are tastier." Sam Willis was out of action for several months, and because of his almost severed tongue, he was never able to lash people with it as of old. It was a marvellous bit of luck for Frank Moffat. The lawsuit dragged on for months and months. But eventually, the thing that clinched his case was that Willis falling really proved the ladder was dangerous. I had to give evidence, of course. I didn't lie, though I have to admit I didn't exactly tell the whole truth. That is, I kept quiet about Frank bawling me out for stopping him falling the first time. In the end, they settled out of court for an undisclosed sum. I never found out how much it was, but it must have been substantial because it enabled Frank to buy a small pub not far from Ditchling in Sussex. He got in just at the right time before the property explosion. He'd no doubt been selecting it in the dressing room when I saw him perusing estate agents' brochures. Whenever I'm in the Brighton area, I try to drop in on him. He's so much more friendly than he used to be. At least he is to me. I'm the last person in the world to take advantage of anybody, but I must admit it's a nice feeling to visit a pub where the landlord and I have a shared secret. And as long as my lips remain sealed, it means there's always somewhere where I'm sure of a warm welcome, an unbounded hospitality. Now and again, you still hear an Andrews Sisters record on the radio. Whenever I hear them, I'm always reminded of the Rich Brothers. I met up with them first when I was filling in as a theatrical touring manager soon after the war. The show was a sophisticated pre-war comedy, but unfortunately, as I said, the war was over. Tastes had changed. We were billed as prior to the West End, but it would have been truer to say prior to oblivion, for the nearest we ever got to the West End was the old Hippodrome, Golders Green, which of course has long since been gobbled up by the BBC, whose judgment in this respect it would obviously be professional suicide for me to question. The play was never heard of again. But in spite of its complete failure, I look back on the tour as a very happy one. All of us fated to be out of work at the end of it, but oblivious. Every week was a sort of holiday, particularly if you had good digs. At their best, theatrical digs were a home from home. Better than a lot of people's homes, and the very best of all were in Bradford. Mrs. Winthrop's. They were not just the best in Bradford, they were the best anywhere. In fact, the only thing against them was that they were in Bradford. Mrs. Winthrop ran her place like a miniature hotel. Spotlessly clean, wonderful meals, full board, and no chat. This last is always a bonus. Mrs. Winthrop was perfection. I suppose there must have been a Mr. Winthrop some time or other. I never heard him mentioned, and I never asked. You never know when a question like that can open the floodgates. But there was a son, Eric. When I first stayed there, he was a neat little chap in short trousers. He'd be standing at the front door when the pros arrived. Hair smarmed down, face scrubbed, collar and tie. He'd help with the bags. Wouldn't accept a tip. A pleasure, Mr. Kingsley Platt, he would say. Perfect manners. Mrs. Winthrop was justifiably proud of him. He was in the choir at the local church. He was a Boy Scout. He was studying to be an accountant. He'd keep out of the way during the week until the time came for us to leave, when he would again help with the baggage. He grew up into a very good-looking young man. He was 20 at the time I'm going to tell you about. Tall, slim. He helped us with the bags, as usual. Now, there are a lot of landlady's daughter jokes, most of them in very poor taste. And on arrival, thinking she'd be pleased and flattered, I made some light-hearted remark to Mrs. Winthrop about her having the male equivalent of the legendary landlady's daughter. I can't remember exactly what I said, but I clearly remember it didn't go down at all well. It occurred to me then, for the first time, that Mrs. Winthrop had never had anyone of the fair sex staying with her when I'd been a guest. I came to the conclusion then that she didn't want her son Eric, her pride and joy, fraternising with any loose-living theatricals. In other words, she was the classic overprotective mum. But I didn't think about it for very long. Too much to do. Right, now, having tried to give you a picture of Mrs. Winthrop, I'll tell you about the three rich brothers. Only two were real brothers. Eccentric comedy and music. They were very successful at the time I'm talking about. They toured the States, Europe, Australia. Stan Rich, the eldest, more or less inherited the basic act from his father, who'd also worked a three-handed act on the halls. But the sons adapted it and added to it. The Rich brothers, as I remember them, presented a mishmash of stolen material, but it worked. It was fast and slick and surefire. They had excellent musical arrangements. They never took risks. Imagine three men in white suits. Tight trousers, bowler hats a bit too big so they came down to their eyebrows, all three with Charlie Chaplin stuck-on moustaches, a phone box in the middle of the stage, and they sort of fight each other to get into it. One gets in, and then the other two make friends with each other and take the side off the phone box and drag it away so the one making the call is left in the open holding the phone. They cut the wire. He goes on talking. Then somehow he gets back and pulls the box together again. The others pull the wire and it falls over on its side. The other two put their bowler hats on the horizontal door and say a prayer as if it's a coffin. And so on. There's a lot of hurry music going on all through this. Plenty of work for percussion. I don't expect this makes a lot of sense to you, but believe me, when I saw the original French version in Paris, Les Trois something or other, it brought the house down. Stan Rich must have seen it too, because he incorporated it into their act. He also stole the idea of miming to an Andrews Sisters record from a well-known American act. The Three Riches would have to leave the stage for this. It took them about 5 seconds to change into gingham dresses and blonde wigs. And during that 5 seconds, they trained a small dog to walk on the stage, sniff at the phone box, and cock his leg up against it. Always got a round of applause. A moment later, the phone box would collapse, an idea they picked up from a nightclub act in Berlin. It always got a huge laugh. And then on the crest of it, the Andrews Sisters part of the act. It always went like a bomb. After a couple of numbers, they'd tear off their gingham dresses and the wigs and go into their finale revealed as three good-looking blokes with quite acceptable voices, singing current hits. They sang well enough to have been a straight singing trio, but the comedy lifted them into another bracket. That week in Bradford, all four of us were staying at Mrs. Winthrop's, and I slipped in to see the Riches doing their stuff at the Alhambra Second House Monday. They tore the place apart. But I have to admit, I didn't really warm to them. There was no spark. I missed any real sense of fun. It was all too calculated. They seemed to have learned to trigger laughs. And in spite of all the applause they generated, I think audiences realised this. They were willing subjects, as it were. But when they left the theatre, I think that was the end of their pleasure. With Sid Field and Jimmy James and a few more, Max Miller certainly, people would leave the theatre laughing and talking about them, and some of the magic would last them the rest of their lives. But not so with the Rich Brothers. Anyway, afterwards, I went round to see them, and we had a couple of beers in their dressing room and then went back to Mrs. Winthrop's for supper. The Riches told me all about their recent tour of Australia. The youngest, the one who wasn't a brother, had had a romance with a girl in Brisbane. The other two pulled his leg about it. We had a few laughs at his expense. We exchanged reminiscences of an amorous nature, and we went to bed. Next morning, Stan and Alan Rich went off to play golf, and I left for an understudy rehearsal. I got back in time for what I thought would be a quiet lunch prior to a refreshing napette. But I opened the front door to find the house vibrating with high drama. Stan Rich was on the phone in the hall. His brother Alan was pacing up and down beside him, puffing furiously at a cigarette. The dog was barking because he sensed something was amiss. Mrs. Winthrop poked her head out of the lounge and pulled me inside. "He's on to his agent," she said, "because the young one's run off. Went as soon as they left to play golf. Left a note saying he's going back to Australia. Some girl, I believe." Then she gave a sort of sniff. It seemed to confirm the impression I'd got on my arrival. Mrs. Winthrop hadn't much time for her own sex, or for men's interest in it. But neither this nor the commotion Stan Rich was creating in the hall prevented her from serving an excellent lunch. I was enjoying the crab salad with homemade mayonnaise when in came Stan and Alan. "You've heard," said Stan. I nodded. "You've got to help me. We're in a terrible spot." "What can I do?" I said. I asked the question not as an indication of willingness to do anything about it, but because I just couldn't think of any way I could help. I was rather flattered when Stan suggested that I should take over the role of the missing brother, but as soon as the words were out of his mouth, I realised I didn't have the dancing or vocal skills required. I might have had a shot at the comedy, though it would have been quite outside anything I'd done before. But I didn't tell him that. I merely explained that my first loyalty must be to my own management, and I could not leave them without anyone in charge, even for an evening. Stan just rattled on. "Alan and me could get anyone through. That git who's left us in the lurch was a novice when he started. By the second house, he was one of us. Right, Alan?" Alan nodded and said the act was foolproof. "Yes," said Stan, "but it had to have three to work it. And if I tell our management we can't go on tonight, they may cancel our bookings for the next 3 months." I made what I thought was a helpful suggestion. "One of the strengths of your act is the straight singing at the end. Why not add a few more numbers to make up the time and just do a straight musical act without comedy or anything that requires the three of you?" Stan barely let me finish. "That would not be the Rich Brothers," he said. "We're contracted to appear as known. We should be in trouble. But here you are, an experienced performer." I had made the mistake the night before of exaggerating what I'd done on the boards. "You're an actor. I thought actors could do anything." "I wish I were free to help you," I said. "Bloody actors," he said. "Snobs, that's what they are." There's often this ridiculous prejudice between variety and legitimate performers. Not the top-liners. They always recognise talent regardless of anything else. I could say more about that, but some other time. Just as Stan Rich made that unfortunate remark, I heard Eric Winthrop come in. I had a sudden inspiration. I said to Stan, "What about Eric? He used to sing in the choir, and him having been a Boy Scout, he probably still likes to do the occasional good turn. Perhaps he could do you one." But I hadn't finished the sentence before the two of them had rushed out. They ran upstairs to Eric's room. Presently I heard a lot of shouting, including the raised voice of Mrs. Winthrop, unusual that. She was obviously very upset. I'd just finished a piece of her apple and sultana flan with real egg custard when she came in with the coffee. She looked ruffled and her eyes were red. I opened my mouth to speak, but she held up her hand to stop me. She put down the coffee, cleared the dirty plates, and went out without a word. As she opened the door, I heard the sound of three voices harmonising upstairs. Mrs. Winthrop gave a sniff and disappeared into the kitchen. It was obvious that my suggestion had borne fruit. After about an hour, Stan and his brother came downstairs, and Stan spoke to me over his shoulder as they went out the front door with Eric. Going to rehearse the comedy business down at the theatre, he said. Eric gave a thumbs-up sign, and off they went. Not a word of thanks for the suggestion, but that is par for the course. Now, when I offered some advice to Sir Alexander Corder in the wake of the I. Claudius debacle... But no, no, that is another story. Later that evening, curiosity getting the better of me, I was able to slip away from the Prince's along to witness the debut of Eric Winthrop as a rich brother. It's hard to describe. I've told you about the act already, an act with comedy business, dancing, singing, miming in drag. An act, moreover, polished to a slickness rarely seen in this country or even in the States. Well, with this new recruit, who, remember, had never been on the professional stage in his life before, and had had a bare 4 hours rehearsal, there was no difference. It was the same act I'd seen the night before. It was depressing, in a way, because it gave the lie to the legend of how hard the work is and what patience and dedication go into any sort of success. But I have to admit it worked. Two things were in their favour, of course. One was that, as Alan put it, the act was foolproof. The other was that Eric didn't have a nerve in his body. It seemed so extraordinary to me, still does, that this young man was able to just slip on a gingham dress and a long blonde wig, with a perfectly straight face and no sign of embarrassment or inhibition. And when they whisked off the dresses and wigs for the finale, he was actually better than the other boy had been, had a better voice and a fine sense of rhythm. The Alhambra manager was standing at the back of the stalls as I left, and I nodded to him. "Great act," I said. Although we both knew he had nothing whatsoever to do with booking it, he gave a proprietary smile. "They never miss," he said. He didn't even know there'd been a change of cast. I went back to attend to my work at the Prince's. It didn't take long to fill in the returns. A mere 48 people had ignored the advice of the Guardian critic and had turned out to see the Duke of Deauville. I told the cast to cheer up, business was building nicely, and went back to Mrs. Winthrop's. She wasn't there to give the customary welcome, but she had laid on a first-class cold collation with all the trimmings and put a nice bottle of Suave on ice by way of apology for the meal not being hot, and a short note saying she hadn't been able to cook owing to circumstances beyond her control. Sometime later, after their second house, Stanrich and Alan arrived with Eric. They brought a couple of bottles of champagne by way of celebration, and they gave me at least 2 glasses. Of course, they were glowing with success. "Don't tell me," I said. "I saw it all first house." "Amazing! Congratulations, Eric. You are a real pro." I looked across at Stan. "One of my better suggestions, hmm?" "What?" he says. "What?" He'd completely forgotten who had suggested Eric. Well, that's happened to me a lot. People forget so soon. Anyway, the unbelievable happened. Eric Winthrop became a star overnight. Now, I'm exaggerating. Let us say he changed from being a young office worker who was studying to become an accountant into a third and important part of a very successful variety act. Mind you, Eric met with a lot of opposition before he decided to ignore his mother and accept Stan's offer. He knew nothing about the economics of show business, and so he thought the money sounded good. After all, 40 quid was quite a lot in those days. And the offer came just at a time when Eric was disenchanted with his accountancy studies. So the idea of working for 20 minutes twice a night and seeing the world at someone else's expense was a lot more attractive than poring over ledgers from 9 to 5 and never leaving Bradford, and his mother's strict surveillance. So Eric agreed to join the Rich Brothers on a permanent basis. Mrs. Winthrop was very subdued for the rest of that week. She continued to function as efficiently as ever. I suppose in her own way she was as much a pro as any of us, but I could tell it was a considerable effort. She never went along to the Alhambra to see Eric. What passed between them during those 5 nights before Eric left with the riches, I do not know. But there must have been some bitter exchanges. I suppose she'd seen too much of theatricals at close quarters to be anything but depressed about her son choosing the life himself. I suppose it pretty well broke her heart. Eric, on the other hand, thrived on the showbiz atmosphere. He even embellished the act with 1 or 2 touches of his own. Well, not really his own, bits he picked up from other acts on the various bills they shared, and also from a Jerry Lewis picture that was a big hit at the time. Eric worked up a passable imitation of Jerry Lewis and incorporated it into the act. Stan didn't mind this. He didn't care who got the laughs and applause, so long as the act worked. Well, Stan was a businessman, but not, definitely not, as good a businessman as Eric Winthrop. And the day Eric discovered that Stan was being paid $400 a week and only passing 10% of it in Eric's direction, then the days of the rich brothers were numbered. First, Eric put it to Stan that as the act was earning $400, about $2,000 in today's money, he, Eric, was surely entitled to a third of it. Stan was firm. He pointed out a few age-old showbiz clichés to the effect that Eric had been an unknown when Stan had discovered him. Stan, who had never had an original thought in his head, probably told Eric that he'd plucked him out of the gutter and made him a star. He pointed out how easy it had been to find him as a replacement when the previous rich brother had absconded in Bradford. He believed he would be just as lucky again. But by the end of the week, he'd relented. He probably had a word with his London agent. Anyway, he offered Eric another fiver. Too late. And too little. Eric had already made his arrangements. After the show on the Saturday night, he took the train to London. Unperturbed, Stan and Alan went up to Scotland for their next booking. Their agent sent a replacement. But when the three of them met in Glasgow and Stan explained the Andrews sisters' routine and the gingham dresses and wigs, his sexual insecurity got the better of him and he got the first train back to London. In fact, with the departure of Eric Winthrop, the rich brothers were finished. Meanwhile, in London, Eric got busy. He hired and rehearsed two very attractive girls in his own version of the rich brothers' act. Girls are usually cheaper and they work harder because of the greater competition, you see. So I'm sure Eric enjoyed auditioning them, and he picked out two real crackers. Nevertheless, on stage, their charms were hidden beneath the same style suits as the originals. Same bowler hats a bit too big and the same Charlie Chaplin moustaches. They opened with the same phone box routine. They trained a dog to pee against the phone box. And to save tipping a stagehand, Eric cut out the box collapsing and substituted a sunflower growing up the side, which he worked himself. Got just as big a laugh when they tried the act out in Chatham. Eric made a bit more of the Jerry Lewis imitation, in spite of threatening noises from the producers of the movie, and they kept the Andrews sisters bit just as it was, with the girls wearing false noses as well as the dresses and the wigs, so the audience believed they were men in drag. So, when they snatched off the gingham dresses and were revealed as two smashing girls and a good-looking bloke, well, it was a coup de théâtre, as Harold Hobson might have said. They looked like Bucks Fizz or one of those. Benefiting from Stan's experience with himself, Eric put the girls under long-term contract, one of them for longer than he reckoned with, for they got married in America the following year. Yes, Eric got a coast-to-coast booking in the States without the assistance of an agent, thus saving 10%. There was an account of it in the Professional Weekly. Eric wrote it himself. I remember meeting Stan Rich in Shaftesbury Avenue a week or so after it came out. He was obviously a broken man. I asked after his brother Alan. He shrugged. No idea, he said. The act's finished, washed up. There is no act any more. The Rich brothers are dead. All due to me hiring a bloody amateur. He stopped and moved a bit closer to me. It was your bloody idea, wasn't it? But by that time I'd crossed the street against the lights and hurriedly mingled with the crowd on the other side. I hate scenes. If it made Stan feel any better to blame me, let him, I don't mind. But it's my opinion he deserved all he got. He'd been mean to Eric. And of course he couldn't sue him for stealing the material. That must have hurt worst of all. Because, as I told you at the beginning, Stan and his brother had stolen the material in the first place. From an act in Paris from the Bernard brothers, Jerry Lewis and half a dozen others. He didn't have a case. Of course, I admit Eric didn't really deserve the success he had handed to him on a plate. But you have to admire the way he was able to grab his chances with both hands. Later on, he bought property in Las Vegas and Florida just before the boom and made an even bigger fortune on Wall Street. I don't begrudge him any of that. But what rankles with me is that as a result of him leaving his mother flat as he did, she gave up running digs forever. Twice I've played Bradford since those days without the compensation of Mrs. Winthrop's digs. So both times I've stayed with a little woman in Halifax. If you know Halifax, you may wonder why. I mean, that I actually preferred staying there tells you something of how I feel about Bradford. If any listeners in Bradford resent these remarks, forget it. After all, Bradford always ignored me during my many visits in spite of blanket publicity. So why should anybody up there care what I think?
Late 1949 found me standing poleaxed in a corridor at Boreham Wood Studios. I'd just had an unsuccessful interview for the part of a corpse in a low-budget thriller. I was so disappointed and angry that I think if I'd had a gun, I would have shot myself there and then, just to prove my suitability to the director who'd rejected me. Fortunately, my survival mechanism soon started working again, and I went along to the canteen and treated myself to the set lunch. Well, treated is hardly the right word. It was curried cat food served on a bed of unsweetened rice pudding. I was trying to choke this vile combination down when a cheerful young man in RAF uniform asked me if he might join me. He said we'd met during the war when I was touring Air Force bases with a show called Chins Up. He explained that he was wearing his old uniform because he was official advisor on a film called Dinghy, with an exclamation mark, and was feeling depressed because the producers were ignoring his advice. I explained that advisers were employed not to make sure everything was authentic, but so that producers could take what liberties they liked and have an expert to blame if there was criticism later. Clive was so interested in my professional activities that I felt obliged to make an effort. He began by telling me that he wanted to get started as a film producer. He'd inherited his father-in-law's ornamental brass business, so he wasn't short of a few bob. But he wasn't mad enough to try and finance a picture with all his own money. For a ghastly moment, I thought he was going to ask me to help with financial backing myself, which would have entailed disappointing both of us. He leaned over and whispered in my ear, "It's a blue movie." He got it out at last, and then went on quickly to prevent me raising an objection. A Dutch business contact of mine in ornamental brassware has an interest in offbeat clubs on the continent. Snag is, he doesn't have the facilities for this type of subject, but since there's a big demand, he wants to jump on the bandwagon, and I'm pretty sure that if I can come up with what he wants, then he'll go along with me later and back me in something above board. Processing, he can cope with himself. So if we can shoot the footage here and get it over to him, our troubles are over. I noted the introduction of the "we" and adopted it myself. But how do we get it over to him? I was thinking of the English and Dutch customs officers, who were very puritanical at the time. I've worked all that out. I've got an old Humber shooting brake, and my idea is to take my wife Sally and the kids over to Holland with the cans of undeveloped film hidden underneath a lot of camping gear and toys in the back. With Sally and six kids, no customs man in the world is going to suspect we've got anything we shouldn't have. If you'll find some time to organise a unit, a skeleton crew and a cast, and take charge during the day's shooting, I'll split with you 50-50. I looked inscrutable. The Dutchman is going to pay 3,000 on delivery, in pounds, so if we can make the picture for 2 grand, then we get 500 apiece. This was big money in those far-off days, but of course I pulled a face. I've got a script here. It's called The Eager Bride, and he produced a foolscap envelope from his briefcase. It's a bit sketchy as it stands, but we should naturally do quite a bit of work on it on the floor. Improvisation. Exactly. What do you say? I'm in. Provided I get my out-of-pocket expenses. Done. We shook hands. I have an idea for a studio, I said, after I'd looked at the crude little script. It's a small place used for commercial stills, but it might just be big enough. The owner's a friend of mine, so I must find a way of hiring it without telling him what we want it for. Otherwise, naturally, he'll screw us for the rental. But I'll find a way round that. Now, I have a number of important engagements this afternoon. I lied smoothly. But I'll go round to the studio and see if my friend is there. Also, look at the premises to make sure they're suitable. I have a pretty tight schedule this evening, too, but I'll try to get home early and work out a rough budget. I'll phone you around midnight. Good man, said Clive, and gave me his number. The Stills man was out when I got to the studio, which turned out to be lucky because I was able to have a chat with his receptionist and got some useful information. Jan, she told me, stressing his first name in such a way as to leave me in no doubt as to what their true relationship was, Jan is on location but'll be around for the rest of the week, except possibly Friday afternoon. We always go to the cottage at the weekend, and sometimes we get away early. Saturday would suit me perfectly, I said. It's only a little test commercial for Ovaltine. All I need to shoot is a man's hand, a woman's hand, and a steaming hot mug. She said she thought Jan would be agreeable, and I asked if I could take a look at the place again, just to refresh my memory. When I saw it, I was delighted. There was a large divan, ideal for what we wanted, and several other props which would help to dress the set. The ceiling was a bit low for overhead shots, but I judged that if we kept the bed low on the ground and used clever lighting, it could be coped with, given the cooperative cast. Which brought me to the next problem. Nowadays, there are plenty of experienced performers doing this sort of work, and any number are willing to give it a go. But in the 50s, these people were thin on the ground. I had a number of very depressing interviews before I got hold of the name and address of a woman in Wembley Park, Mrs. Gloria Edgecliffe. I went to see her and her husband at their tasteful little flat. She was an attractive 28 or 30 and looked neat and trim in a gingham housecoat, her hair tied up in a turban-style scarf. She showed me into the lounge and closed the doors leading to the dinette. "My little boy is in there doing his homework," she explained in a high-pitched squeak. I told myself the voice didn't matter because we were shooting mute and leaving the Dutchman to get the film dubbed. She introduced me to her husband and we shook hands. He then pulled the blinds, though it was still light outside. "Nosy Parker's round here," he gave his wife a nudge. She took this as her cue and immediately slipped off her housecoat and the underwear underneath. She was so quick it seemed like a conjuring trick. She turned round a couple of times to allow me to have a good view of her stock-in-trade and then offered me a piece of homemade fudge from a box on the mantelpiece. I hum-hummed approval. "All right, dear," he said as she helped herself to another piece of fudge. "Relax a moment while I talk to the gentleman." She slipped on a cardigan and sat down with some knitting. "I wish I could have seen your wife work. It would help me to decide." "Let her strip for you," he said eagerly. I said I thought she already had. "No, no, we just wanted you to see her body, but she does a great strip. Gloria, go and slip on your little oyster silk brocade and give the gentleman a run through." She laid her knitting aside and disappeared into the bedroom. He went to the radiogram and put on a record. "I won't put it full on because of Derek," he said, pointing to the double doors. "Homework," he reminded me. The stripper music began and the bedroom door opened. Mrs. Edgecliffe sashayed into the room wearing a shapely white frock, which I made a mental note to ask her to wear for the eager bride. She still wore the turban scarf. She stood on the hearthrug, undulating from head to foot. Mr. Edgecliffe was kneeling down a few feet in front of her with his hands held in front of his face like a great conductor leading his orchestra through a quiet passage. He spoke in a near whisper. "All right, dear, start to peel." Mrs. Edgecliffe changed gear and gyrated her pelvis and threw back her head so that the turban was tossed aside and her hair came cascading down her back. Slowly, her hands caressed their way round her waist to her rear. "Easy does it," murmured Mr. Edgecliffe. "Take all the time in the world. That's it. Gently does it." The dress slipped down over her thighs with tantalizing slowness. She kicked it aside, and Mr. Edgecliffe picked it up and arranged it over the hanger he'd been holding in readiness. After caressing her thighs in a way that I was afraid might make a partner seem redundant, she undid the buttons on the suspender belt which supported her sheer stockings. She tossed the belt aside and flashed a wink at her imaginary groom. Peeling off the stockings took ages, and all the time Mr. Edgecliffe was whispering words of encouragement. She raised her arms above her head and leaned backwards. When she was horizontal, she gave several frenzied twists of her pelvis and stomach muscles preparatory to removing her lacy panties, which I noticed were beautifully embroidered with the letters G.E. "All her own work," murmured Mr. Edgecliffe proudly. "She's a genius with her needle." Once this frilly example of her craft had reached her feet, she used her big toe as a fulcrum and spun it round 3 times and flicked it across the room in a huge arc. The alert Mr. Edgecliffe caught it with both hands in a style not out of place at Lord's. She jumped off the bed, and holding hands and laughing, they both bowed. After a tedious half-hour's bargaining, we settled on a fee to cover both Mrs. Edgecliffe and her husband. He insisted on being present for all shooting. It was a great load off my mind to get my female star signed up, as I knew that the 2 smaller parts wouldn't cause any trouble, and I'd now be free to concentrate on my search for the pivotal role of the sexy waiter. I shook hands, and Gloria, having slipped on her housecoat again, called her son Derek. He came out of the dinette and showed us the rainfall map of Britain, which he'd been working on during his mother's demonstration. I said I hoped we hadn't disturbed him. He didn't speak in reply, merely winked. I shall never understand children. I hurried back to the West End to see a Jamaican limbo dancer whom I'd arranged to meet in the dingy club at which he was appearing. At 2 p.m. it was even dingier than normal, and the limbo dancer proved to have a female partner from whom he refused to be separated, even for the duration of the interview. He told me they'd be pleased to do anything that a man and a woman can do together, and I swear to you that they were prepared to give me an audition there and then. When I revealed that we already had a leading lady, the female partner gave her boyfriend a vicious slap on the face, and they started screaming at each other. So, while they were distracted, I slipped out of the fire exit and past the overflowing waste bins. I was still in the dark alley when I heard footsteps behind me and someone hissing to catch my attention. It was a well-built black man in a barman's jacket. "Excuse me," he said in a public school accent, "but I couldn't help overhearing your conversation in the club. I'm the barman, by the way, Geoffrey." He held out his hand, and I shook it very warmly indeed to show how unprejudiced I was. "I wondered whether I might be able to oblige," he asked with a knowing wink. I must have looked interested, because he went on, "I loathe people who boast of their sexual prowess, but I've been fairly active in that area, and, well, let's say I've had few complaints. Do you think you might consider me?" I asked him if he had any acting experience. "Only at university, but I've done a bit of extra work in rather trashy films." I was quite impressed. I told him I'd have a word with my co-producer and let him know something soon. I didn't need to make any decision then, because I knew that at least I had a possible sexy waiter and a definite first-class bride. Casting the inadequate husband and the pert chambermaid was merely a matter of a phone call. Having done that, I was free to concentrate on the more difficult task of engaging a crew. I had already mulled this problem over in my mind and decided to approach a rather elderly cameraman, Fred Mundy, who lived nearby. Apart from his age, Fred had 2 disadvantages. He was deaf and he smoked an evil-smelling pipe. Although it was never out of his mouth, he'd not mastered the art of keeping it alight, nor had he mastered the art of using his lighter efficiently. So, what with his deaf aid, his pipe and his lighter, he was, most of the time, too busy with his hands to be able to do much else. Nevertheless, he knew about lighting sets, and he would have one big advantage as an employee. He would be grateful. I arranged to meet him at the Goat and Compasses, and when I arrived he was relighting his pipe with such concentration that I didn't dare interrupt him to announce myself. He was puffing and blowing and pressing the tobacco down with his left forefinger, and with his right hand he was flipping the wheel of a lighter, which was already burning like something in a torchlight procession. Eventually the lighter got too hot for him, and it clattered to the floor. An alert barmaid squirted soda water on it as it burned away on the lino. Fred rebuked her for interfering, and if he hadn't suddenly become aware of me standing there, I think there might have been a heated argument. Excuse the pun. Heated. He shook hands and switched on his deaf aid. A sound came out of it like a public address system being switched on. What can I do for you, young man? He asked. I opened my mouth, and it struck me quite suddenly that I couldn't tell him what I was there to tell him without about 15 complete strangers in the bar overhearing me. I leaned over to speak quietly into his appliance, and he emitted 2 lungfuls of noxious fumes. I pulled back, coughing. He naturally didn't understand what my problem was, and was getting impatient. Since the other people in the bar had stopped talking to each other and were looking at us, I decided to offer Fred the job without telling him the type of film we were making. To keep his interest, I fell back on the story of the Ovaltine commercial. He was obviously delighted at the prospect of working again, and he bought several rounds of drinks for strangers by way of celebration. He was very merry indeed by closing time, and as I walked him home, he was too drunk for me to explain the true nature of the job he'd been engaged for. Nevertheless, we shook hands on our bargain, and I left him on his doorstep, his lighter held to his ear and trying to light his pipe with his deaf aid. Next day, Clive and I spent a couple of hours with Geoffrey. We decided to take a chance with him and fixed a mutually acceptable fee that was a good deal less than we'd expected to pay. Another week of preparations brought us to the eve of the big day. I saw Jan, the photographer, off to the cottage with his indiscreet receptionist on the Friday night, and Clive gave me a hand moving our stuff in. I ran through the schedule with Clive, and he said it was all just super. Then he told me about his own arrangements. Sally was going to drive the kids up from the country in the Humber shooting break and pick up the two of us about 6 in the evening. I pointed out that it was going to be a bit crowded with 6 kids and 3 adults, but Clive said it wasn't a long journey to Dover, and when he docked at Amsterdam, a full load would deter customs from scrutinising us. I took his word for it. Next morning, after a good old-fashioned breakfast, I got a taxi and picked up the camera, etc., and was at the studio by 7:15. Clive arrived a few minutes later, and together we got the gas ring going and found some coffee cups. Mr. and Mrs. Edgecliffe were the first to arrive, and after grabbing a coffee each, they made a beeline for the bed. "Make sure it's right for you, dear," he said. She slipped off her shoes and stood on it. Then she jumped up and down, knelt, rolled, gyrated, bumped, and finally lay down flat. "It's a teeny-weeny bit soft." Mr. Edgecliffe explained that Gloria liked to work on a firm surface. We'd just put a piece of hardboard under the mattress when Geoffrey arrived, and we were soon busy with introductions. A moment later we were joined by Neville, the prop man, still spry at 73, and Fred Mundy and his assistant, a shifty-eyed youth who was dressed more expensively than anyone else there. The makeup girl, Doris, who I happened to know was an expelled bunny, arrived late and out of breath, and just as I was beginning to think they may not turn up at all, we discovered the 2 small parts sitting in the minuscule dressing room at the back. I clapped my hands and shouted that we must all get down to work. This was a signal for Fred to shake his head at the lights. Then he shook his head at the camera. Then he looked round the studio and shook his head yet again. This last gesture of despair seemed to take in every aspect of our enterprise, and I became quite apprehensive because I knew Fred was anticipating photographing a modest commercial for Ovaltine, and had no idea yet that he was about to start making his first blue movie. I drew him aside and explained that I hadn't been able to speak freely at the Goat and Compasses and hadn't had a chance to phone him and explain exactly the type of picture I envisaged. While I was talking, he picked up a copy of the flimsy script and was thumbing through it. Suddenly he looked at me, his eyes bulging. "It's blue," he said. "It's a blue movie." He was getting overexcited, and I was afraid he might not last the distance. "Why didn't you tell me, eh? Eh? What did you mean about Ovaltine?" He banged his deaf head as though he believed I was giving explanations that were inaudible to him. I tried to divert his attention by introducing him to Clive, the speed of whose response was worthy of his fighter pilot days. He shook Fred by the hand and shouted that he had always wanted to work with him ever since he'd seen Fred's award-winning work in Forgotten Waterways of Britain, a picture he made 20 years before. I called for the cast, and we went over the first scene. The action called for the maid to open the bedroom door, show in the bride and groom, turn round, and see the sexy waiter passing with a tray. She then had to whisper in his ear and point towards the closed door. He had to stoop and look through the keyhole. Dissolve. This was where we planned to have the 3-minute stripping scene from the point of view of the keyhole. There followed another short scene outside the bedroom door in which the husband had to walk out in a huff and the waiter had to walk in looking sexy. We decided to shoot this last out of sequence to save setting up twice. Also, these little corridor scenes were simple and would serve to break the ice. They should have been no trouble at all. Unfortunately, Fred was having problems with the camera. It was a Brunner Mark 9 and in good condition, but Fred kept banging the side of it, much as he banged his deaf aid. He seemed to have no other remedy for things mechanical. While he was fussing, Don, his immaculate assistant, was arranging the lights and seizing every chance to chat up the pert chambermaid. The makeup girl patted the artist's noses and arranged a wisp of Gloria's hair. Fred checked a light, looked over to me, and nodded. "Quiet, please," I shouted. "Action!" At last, I thought, we are on our way. I could hardly have been more wrong. How can I explain? From that moment when I shouted action, it was as if the Creator up there in the great control room in the sky had gathered all his acolytes, angels, call them what you will, assistants, and had pointed with his Michelangelo forefinger down at number 22B Soho Lane and said to them, "For the rest of today, I want you all to drop whatever else you are doing and concentrate on making life unbearable for the director of the blue movie, The Eager Bride. His name is J. Kingston Platt, and I don't want any excuses from any of you. Give him hell." The two supporting actors, the inadequate husband and the pert chambermaid, had rehearsed their short and undemanding roles quite well, but the word action had on them the opposite effect that the smell of gunpowder is said to have on cavalry horses. They both became unsure of themselves and tongue-tied. The inadequate husband tripped as he entered the room, and the pert chambermaid closed the door with such nervous energy that the knob came off in her hand. It was a close shot, and we should not have seen the doorknob had she not held it up like a conjurer producing an egg out of thin air. We put it back. I took her aside and explained that there was nothing to worry about. I should have remembered that this always has the opposite effect to that which is intended, and it did in this case. Her face went a deep beetroot colour, and she was in no way pert. The mishaps increased rapidly in tempo and scale. The chambermaid's friend and protector arrived, and despite the fact that he was carrying on a torrid affair with her nightly in his mirror-lined flat overlooking Regent's Park, he was aggrieved at the possibility of any of his brother barristers going to a blue movie and recognising the pert chambermaid as his mistress. After a few words, the irate QC picked her up and carried her bodily out into the street where his Aston Martin was throbbing at the curbside. He chucked her into the passenger seat on top of his bowler hat, got in the other side, and drove away dangerously. It was upsetting and would have been a lot worse had I not realised that by leaving without permission she had forfeited her fee. Fortunately, we had a version of sorts of the only scene of hers that really mattered, and I told Clive that with clever cutting the rest would not be missed. I asked Fred to confirm this, but he merely stared at me blankly and turned up the volume of his deaf aid. The static echoed round the little studio and was so loud that even Fred's insensitive ears were penetrated. He gave the appliance a great clonk with the bowl of his pipe. There was a flash and a puff of smoke, and then silence. The deaf aid had finally capitulated, and from then on, communication with Fred was by sign language alone. We decided to start on the stripping scene, and knowing how very professional Gloria Edgecliffe was, I prepared for it with a good deal of confidence. Action! The word had the magical effect on Gloria that I had expected. She reproduced exactly the performance she'd given in her Wembley flat. But now, with good lighting and film makeup, she was the knockout I had predicted. Everything went perfectly up to the moment when she removed her panties without using her hands. This dexterous manoeuvre won a round of applause from her admiring audience. "Cut!" I shouted, and Mr. Edgecliffe was on hand with the cardigan. "Well done," I said. Very sincerely I congratulated all concerned, and very quickly I pointed out that time was getting on and I wanted to get on with the big scene. But first I had to get the reaction shots of the inadequate husband out of the way. The obvious success of Gloria's strip scene had had a cheering effect, and I was working confidently and well. Unfortunately, the scene had also affected the inadequate husband. He was now incapable of giving a few simple looks at the bed to indicate inadequacy and sexual fear. He could only leer and roll lascivious eyes. I took him on one side. "There's a plain-clothes officer outside," I said. "He has a woman with him who claims to be the mother of your child. I have asked them to wait while you play this scene, and by the way, your wife is on the phone. She also has agreed to wait." This was a shot in the dark, but it worked. We got three shots of the inadequate husband looking very inadequate indeed. "Good old Stanislavski," I said to myself. At last, the decks were clear for our raison d'etre. We had a short break for lunch and started on the really blue part of the movie. During the lunch break, scaffolding was put up over the divan and our two stars got into position so that Fred had a bird's-eye view. As soon as he'd got the bed in focus, Fred called for more lights. Don switched on another light. There was a puff of smoke, and the whole studio was plunged into darkness. Obviously, the circuit was overloaded. I groped my way towards the fuse box. There was a lot of shouting, and several people struck matches. I heard Fred flicking his lighter. Mr. Edgecliffe's voice rose above the rest. It sounded hysterical. He was shouting at Gloria and Geoffrey. He was shouting very loudly indeed. He was telling them to stop acting and get off the bed. I didn't hear Gloria or Geoffrey offering to comply with his request, but I did hear Mr. Edgecliffe leap onto the bed himself and attempt to separate them. At this moment, Fred's lighter, which he had been flicking all this time, suddenly burst into flames with such suddenness that he let it fall from his hand straight onto the bed and its three occupants. The old prop man suddenly sprang first to life and then in the direction of the fire extinguisher. Before anyone could stop him, he'd wrenched it free, slammed the end on the ground, and directed the resulting spray onto the bed. The flames went out straight away, but in spite of the screams and shouts of stop it and take it away, the old fool continued to spray foam all over the area. During the screaming and shouting, I struggled to get the lights on again. At last, I got the fuse in, and I slammed the box shut and pulled the main switch. For a split second, the studio was brilliantly lit up. In that moment, I saw that foam covered everything from wall to ceiling. Stalactites hung from the scaffolding. It was smeared over the lights. The bed itself looked like a giant meringue pie. Gloria, Geoffrey, and Mr. Edgecliffe were like three snowmen, struggling to disentangle themselves and to get the foam out of their ears, eyes, and everywhere else. Then, since Fred had not reduced the lights, the circuit was just as overloaded as it had been before. There was another puff of smoke, and we were back to square one and in the dark. There were audible signs of panic. As I rushed back to the fuse box, I heard Clive's voice telling everyone not to panic and to pull themselves together. The Duke of Edinburgh himself, had he been so foolish as to have involved himself in this situation, could not have behaved with greater aplomb. Practical as well as inspiring, Clive turned off several of the big lamps before I pulled the main switch. At last, we had enough light to start mopping up. Eventually, order was restored, and by making desperate signs and pointing to the hands of my watch, I was able to get Fred back into position on the scaffolding. Gloria and Geoffrey got back on the bed. Something seemed to be missing. Gloria whispered in Geoffrey's ear and then got out of bed and spoke to me. "I think it will be all right if we go into the dressing room for a few minutes and prepare for this scene," she said.
"Oh, no, you don't," a voice thundered from just behind me. It was Mr. Edgecliffe. He took his wife's hand and pulled her towards the door. He turned to me. "We shan't be very long, just having a little family conference." Geoffrey lit a cigarette and hummed quietly to himself. Clive and I exchanged worried glances. The others mumbled to each other. There were a few snickers. We heard some marital clichés being exchanged next door. Clive looked at his watch. He was just about to go and hurry them up when a new sound came from the reception area. It was a troop of children, shouting and clapping. Clive and I looked at each other and simultaneously moved to the door. He pushed it open, and there was Gloria Edgecliffe, starkers, apart from her cardigan, in heated argument with her husband. Standing round them were Clive's wife and six children. Clive dealt with the Edgecliffes first. "Get into the studio immediately." His voice had that note of authority which is such an asset to the officer class and a handful of first assistants. The Edgecliffes nearly knocked me over as they rushed to obey. I went back to the studio and was relieved to find that the Edgecliffes had resolved their problems and were able to get down to work. Progress was slow, but we managed to get some good overhead shots of the action on the bed. In half an hour, Clive came back and said he'd parked the car and left the family in a little Italian cafe down the street. He was delighted to hear Geoffrey had risen to the occasion, and we had shot at least 7 minutes of spicy footage. We set about doing covering shots from different angles, but it was hard work explaining what we wanted to Fred. "Never mind," I thought to myself. "If he's managed to achieve half the quality he did in forgotten waterways of Britain, then our Dutch backers will be very pleased indeed with the eager bride." Looking at it always, I decided that we could have done a lot worse than Fred. Don stayed late to help Clive and me stack the things ready for return to the hire firm. "May I have a private word?" he asked, as soon as we'd all the stuff piled up. "Of course. What is it?" "Well," he said, "it's the camera. I checked it very carefully, and the shutter isn't working properly." It was like a low punch in the stomach. I sat down. "When did it go wrong?" Don put his hand on my shoulder. "It's been wrong all day, I'm afraid. Everything, as they say, went black. "So the fact is," I said, "tell me if I'm wrong, the fact is that at this very moment, my partner Clive is stowing 3 cans of completely unexposed film into his Humber." "Afraid so. Is there anything I can do?" "No," I said. "Go." He stood there. "Go," I repeated. "Just go." He went. I lurched round on the pub on the corner and down 2 large whiskies, one after the other. Clive arrived looking for me. "I'm going to take you and Sally to a celebration dinner," he said, "before we hit the road for jolly old Amsterdam." Quite silently, I screamed to myself. Then I smiled warmly at Clive. "Going to push the boat out, eh? Good idea. We deserve a little celebration." We went to a new place, the Kinchano. Unfortunately, I was not in a fit state to do it justice, fond as I am of good Italian cooking. As I attempted to chat amusingly to Sally and Clive, I tried to guess how and when the Dutch people planned to pay the money. Would it be on delivery of the cans of film, or after they'd seen a screening? Finally, I asked Clive, trying to sound very casual. "I think they'll probably cough up when we meet them at the hotel in the morning," he said. "By the way, I booked you a room at the place we're staying, the Van Ryn. You'll be staying the night, won't you?" I said I would be, and thanked him. "In the hotel," I thought. "Then that will be before they have a chance to have the film developed." I tried to picture the circumstances and didn't notice the veal scallopini arrive. The meal finished at last, and we went back to the car park where the kids were running round like savages. It was a nightmare journey. When we finally reached the ferry, the kids were distracted by the quayside activities, and I excused myself from Sally and Clive and took a stroll round the deck. I was at my wit's end. I just didn't know what to do. Somehow, I had to make sure I got my share of the money before the Dutch people discovered the awful truth. I stared gloomily at the water being churned up by the propellers. Then it hit me. How childishly simple it seemed once I'd got the germ. I went into the saloon and ordered a large cognac, which I sipped while I worked out the details. Clive and Sally came in looking for me. I was feeling confident enough by this time to greet them warmly and buy them a nightcap. I was even up to making a joke about Ovaltine last thing for Sally's benefit. The cognac worked its magic, and we had another couple before Sally and Clive went to their cabin, and I settled down for the night on a bench in the main saloon. I slept well, and in the morning I was one of the first to leave the ship. I had arranged to meet Clive at the hotel for breakfast. I found a phone box just outside the dock area and proceeded with the cunning plan I had conceived the previous night. Having only a small overnight case to carry, I decided to save a few guilders by walking to the hotel. I went up to the room Clive had booked for me and had a bath and a shave. I was down to breakfast by 8:30. I left a message in case the Dutch backers arrived early. I was just finishing a second croissant with unsalted butter and cherry jam when a boy came and told me they were waiting. He led me to the lounge, and they all looked round when I approached. There were 3 of them. Our sponsor, Hendrika, introduced himself and 2 friends. All 3 were expensively dressed, handmade shirts and shoes. "Loaded," I said to myself contentedly. We all shook hands, and I explained that Clive would be joining us shortly as soon as the car was clear of customs. Then I regaled them with a lurid account of the film. I went to town in a way that would have been impossible if I'd not known for certain that they would never be able to compare my description with the real thing. I exaggerated its length, quality, and pornographic voltage. I added to the cast list and described feats of sexual acrobatics which would have required Walt Disney's 600 animators to reproduce on the screen. They drank it in. Why be mean, I thought to myself. After all, this is all the fun they're going to get. So I piled it on. As I talked, I glanced round and was gratified to see the lounge was filling up with detectives. Although Dutch, they were unmistakable and wore the regulation plain clothes of their calling. They came in two at a time and sat around holding newspapers at slightly the wrong angle for reading. I looked at my watch and suggested to the Dutchman that Clive was about due and that we might stroll out to meet him. As we rose, all the detectives in the lounge stood up, looked at each other, and then sat down again. I looked at my companions and was pleased to see they were quite unaware of anything unusual. Like Clive, they believed that once past the customs at the docks, we were in the clear. Suddenly, Hendrika gave a guttural cheer. He had seen Clive's Humber approaching. Apparently, he didn't notice that it was being followed by two police cars crammed with gendarmes. Clive pulled up at the curb, and the kids made catcalls and rude signs as soon as they saw me. Clive gave them a bashing with his newspaper and leapt out and shook hands with the Dutchman. There was a lot of laughing and joking. Sally stayed in the car. Our little group didn't notice the police forming a circle round us, and I guessed they would remain oblivious until the moment the cans of film were produced. There wasn't long to wait. Clive went to the back of the Humber and opened the rear door. I leaned in and picked up the three cans, piled on top of each other like a wedding cake. No sooner had I stood upright than all bedlam broke loose. Police jumped up out of the ground as well as out of the hotel and the vehicles nearby. Each of us was grabbed by at least two of them. A white-haired detective, who reminded me of Lloyd George, made his way towards me as though he knew I was the ringleader. The others moved aside and treated him with deference. Clive went white. The Dutchman went red. I knew this was my big moment. The last thing I wanted was for Hendrika and his friends to find out that the film was unexposed. I had nothing to fear from anyone else. I turned to Lloyd George and gave him my Jean Gabin smile, though I doubt whether he recognized it as such. But what I said did go home. Making sure Clive, Hendrika, and the others couldn't hear, I spoke quietly to Lloyd George. "These people know nothing of all this, Inspector. I have taken advantage of their friendship. I am the man you are looking for. Shall we go?" With that, I stepped into the police car that had drawn up nearby, still holding the three cans of film. Lloyd George was so surprised he just stood there staring. After a moment, he instructed his assistants to take full particulars from the others, and then he joined me in the back seat. The Citroen Big 15 zoomed off along the cobbled streets. Lloyd George offered me a cigarette. I had scarcely lit it before we arrived at police headquarters. Lloyd George politely relieved me of the cans of film. He weighed them in his hands. "Must have a street value of many thousands," he remarked to an assistant, one of many who came out to meet us. I smiled. "Let's go inside and open them," I said. In we went. Well, I won't go into details of what happened in the police examination room, but once they realized there was no trace of any drugs and that the cans contained nothing but unexposed film, they all got very excited and shouted at each other in their native language. Lloyd George was very red-faced and shouted loudest of all. I quietened them down by staring inscrutably at one after the other. When all was silent, I spoke to them. "The way the Dutch police have handled this matter has proved expensive for me," I said. "Those three cans of film cost me hundreds of pounds, and now they are completely useless." Lloyd George apologized. I told him that that was just not good enough, and that I knew there were resources available to the police to pay for mishaps of this kind. I mentioned that I was dining with the British ambassador that night and that the friendship of our two countries was something I treasured above all else. In the end, they coughed up 200 quid. As I stuffed this into my pocket and got up to leave, Lloyd George took me aside and asked me quietly, "Why did you say you were the man we were looking for and that the others knew nothing about it? You seem to be admitting your guilt." "I drew your fire," I said. because I didn't want my old friend Clive Mallory, a decorated war hero and an adored husband and father, to be frog-marched into a police van in front of his wife and children. Oh, I realize he would have been released later, but seeing their daddy seized like a common criminal, those poor kids might have carried the emotional scars to the end of their lives. I felt I had to spare them that. A tear came to Lloyd George's right eye, and he mumbled something about me being an English gentleman. I shook hands and hurried back to explain things to Clive and Hendrika. They were all shocked to hear that the eager bride was a complete write-off. But my dramatic account of how I managed to expose the film to the light and thus prevent the Dutch police from seeing our porno masterpiece soon had them murmuring their appreciation. All except Clive. He remained mystified. "Why did they ever think we were smuggling drugs in the first place?" he asked, just as I knew he would. Fortunately, I had my explanation ready. "I think you overdid it with 6 children. Too much of a good thing. Why would anyone want to bring 6 children over here in the winter unless they had something to hide?" Clive pulled a face and nodded. "Yes," he said, "my fault. I'm sorry I got you involved, Jacko. You must feel pretty resentful after all your work." "Not a bit," I said magnanimously. "Anyway, all is not lost." And with that, I turned my attention to Hendrika and his friends. I told them I was broken-hearted at the loss of the masterpiece. I explained that we had been so carried away that we'd overspent on the production but intended making up the difference out of our own pockets, because we knew that we had made a little classic. Eventually, they got the message. Hendrika put his hand in his pocket and pulled out a handful of guilders, American dollars and French francs. He said they would all like to thank me and begged me to accept this token of their appreciation for the brilliant way I had saved them from serious obscenity charges. Altogether, Clive and I pocketed almost as much as we would have done if they'd paid for the completed picture. We shared it equally, but I decided not to complicate matters by mentioning the compensation I had received from Lloyd George. It would have entailed more tedious explanation. In the end, Clive did very well out of it. He got an order for saucy brass door knockers, which have proved a real winner on the continent and earned the respect and gratitude of his father-in-law. And so I come to the end of this short series, having barely scratched the surface of my treasure trove of memories. I would like to have told you about my fight with Errol Flynn, my food poisoning in Yarmouth, and my romance in a broom cupboard aboard the QE2. How my debut and farewell performance in Modern Dance occurred on the same night in Barcelona, and how I survived an attempt on my life by the back legs of a pantomime horse. Alas, all these must wait for some other time.